Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. We've got a team here that will be responsible for the presentation in the split that we agreed on based on the two meetings, as the Honorable Chair indicated. Ms. Frances Craig here, she is the acting DDG for NAS, or DDG acting, in the absence of Isham, who is out of the country on official duties. She will also be co-presenting together with Thea Carroll. Thea Carroll is the Chief Director responsible for biodiversity planning, has been for the last 2 years prior to CITES, the CITES coordinator or project manager for that period. Behind me, we've got Mr. Matibe. He's coming in here for the first time. So
welcome.
He was here in the front, so I requested him to, we said, you sit at the back when you come for the first time. he's in the biodiversity economy and sustainable use, that space that we are trying to strengthen. So a week or two.
Is the
chief director for that space. We used to have Dr. Marumo some time back, I think 8 months ago, that she left the department. We have Sbo from the DG's office, so she will be doing the coordination from our side, admin related and logistics. Rian is here, sitting at the back, not that it's new. I also have colleagues that I'll be taking to the other side. Sonia Menkis is the director responsible for enforcement in that space, working with Francis. So enforcement matters when we come back, when we are done that side. And the next way is the director responsible for regulations. Her name is Olga Kumalo. She's on the right, that side. The rest of the team. So we will be together in dealing with the things. There's a member that's going to join us, Rose Marcella. She's responsible for wildlife information management. Recently she was in PE, so the connections coming this side, but she's on the way coming. She took the earliest flight that she could. So that's the team. We will go through the presentations as the portfolio committee has instructed us or requested us, being mindful of the other presentations that we have done on this issue. So we didn't want to repeat, but on the basis of the information that is here, some of the things will refer to the earlier discussions that we may have had on these issues. We felt that it was important for us to also print the select committee presentation as is, in case we make some references, because when we talk to the regulations, norms and standards, and any intervention policy related, this is also but one of the tools. So there will be a reference to that as we move along, but we've put it as a separate additional document for reference purposes. That's where we are. As the chair indicated, I will try and see how it works that side, and then as quickly as we can. It's only one item, and it's the first item that side, and then we'll come back with the team with Thea. And Francis will continue. Yeah.
Morning, Honourable Chair, Members, and...
Too far from the mic. Not very loud, this one.
Okay, I'll try my best. Is that audible? Thanks so much. So our first presentation is about the integrated rhino management strategy that we're implementing at the moment, as well as the Constitutional Court judgment on domestic trade in rhino horns. So the purpose is to inform you about the matters relating to the integrated strategic management, as well as the outcomes and the implications associated with that, and how we are taking that process forward. So in terms of the integrated rhino management system and the process we have in place, we thought we'll specifically go back to the cabinet decision. This is an approach that we've been implementing since 2014 already, when cabinet decided that the integrated strategic interventions are required to manage the situation relating to rhino in South Africa. This required a more vigorous approach that involves a number of government departments and entities to reduce the threats that rhinos were facing, as well as enhancing the biological management of the species involved. So the interventions adopted by Cabinet, including a number of areas, specifically compulsory interventions that specifically spoke to the interventions that we've been implementing to date, then on the anti-poaching interventions to inspect and that, specifically speaking to joint operations with our neighboring countries, Mozambique and more specific, improving our intelligence gathering capability and analysis capability, and then also increasing the general protection in the parks for rangers. You might recall that we increased our ranger capability in terms of numbers and training, etc. And also the deployment of certain technologies that could assist us in terms of protection of the rhino. And then also introducing responsive legislation matters addressing emerging issues that arise, and therefore doing those necessary amendments as they develop. Cabinet also required, my apologies, to the computer, has all these messages popping up. So the JCPS cluster ministers in consultation with our minister to develop a security strategy, and you might recall that at previous meetings we referred to the development of the National Integrated Strategy to Combat Wildlife Trafficking that was subsequently developed. Also interventions on international collaboration to strengthen our efforts, and the committee might recall all the MOUs that we've signed with various alleged consumer states as well as range states to strengthen our collaboration with our range states, as well as those states that need to make interventions to address the consumer matters. At the national level, we cabinet approved that we increase our protection in terms of the use of intensive protection zones and the technologies required to secure those zones in the parks, and then proactive intelligence gathering with multiple agencies involved. Cabinet also approved new interventions that included discussion of transnational organized crime and long-term sustainability measures that we can secure the future of the species and the conservation of the species. Of course, those included economic alternatives for communities and creating incentives to promote and facilitate rhino ownership across the board. And the biodiversity economic strategy that we developed, including the rhino lab that we had, subsequent to the cabinet approval of certain recommendations coming out of the committee of inquiry, will assist us in achieving that. So before I go forward, what we also included in the pack is ministers laid the last media statement that was released in terms of our progress in terms of implementing the integrated strategic management approach. So on a quarterly basis, minister will then give feedback based on those direction given by cabinet in 2014. We have four pillars that guide us based on that cabinet approval. And on a quarterly basis, then we minister gives feedback in terms of what is the progress made, and ministers joined in those statements by the Minister of Police and all the other relevant ministers involved in our fight against rhino poaching. So just to cap quickly, to recap, the four pillars are relating to the compulsory interventions, management of rhino populations, which include issues like translocation, etc., long-term sustainability interventions, which is community-focused and legislative-focused, and then the new interventions. And then, of course, those pillars are all underpinned by national, regional, and international collaboration. So you'll see in that statement the feedback that was given in February on our progress in terms of the implementation. So going back to the Rhino Lab, so what we did is we're following this integrated strategic management approach. And in the lab, what we did is we further unpacked what they call a 3C plan, specific actions that we need to also take going forward to further strengthen and enhance our interventions. So you'll see on the screen that it covers law enforcement, which speaks to our compulsory interventions. It covers community engagement, which also speaks to our long-term sustainability. It speaks to demand management, the management of the rhino populations, and responsive legislation. So we further unpack what activities need to happen going forward in more detail in terms of the rhino lab. So under the law enforcement, you'll see there's two aspects, anti-poaching and then the South African Police Service. That is specifically because we have different areas of responsibilities where we are collaborating. So the anti-poaching is all about our anti-poaching units and their capabilities and enhancing those capabilities going forward, strengthening training and the already active elements as well. Then the South African Police Service is responsible for what we call NISQIP, the National Integrated Strategy to Combat Wildlife Trafficking, and their activities are all related to taking that strategy forward and ensuring prosecutions are improved, detection capabilities are addressed, and there's proper collaboration between the law enforcement authorities. In terms of community engagement, there's a project to enhance governance at the community level, specifically with community facilitators. Through our People and Parks program, we already have very good relations with and park forums, etc. So engagement with communities, but further enhancing those through community facilitators that are then drawn from the community. Also enhancing the community danger model. So there's various names for this initiative. You may have heard about Rhino Ambassadors. It's a term that's used. Environmental monitors is a term that's used. The Mamba is one of these that started off like that. So it's basically expanding that model and rolling it out to other areas as well. Then also looking at what economic activities are taking place that we can involve communities with to empower them further, and then allocate resources to support those programs going forward. And also there were concerns about the restorative justice program, the impact of its enforcement on communities, and making sure that we address and have a balance in terms of the enforcement and collaboration issues that are happening. And then also launching a community empowerment plan. In terms of demand management, there's some initiatives around doing more research, peer-reviewed research, through credible funding mechanisms in consumer markets. There's some concerns that the work that's being done doesn't focus on monitoring real impact. So it tends to give us a number of initiatives or actions that have taken place, but it doesn't tell us how behavior has changed through the rollout of certain initiatives. And so looking at those that have a real impact in terms of changing behavior in consumer space. Also looking at alternative options to address demand, also looking at targeted messaging. One of our key concerns is that through the way we communicate and the media also reflect messaging, the situation has actually worsened in terms of communicating negative information, increasing the perceptions about the value of the horn, the scarcity of the horn, etc., which all have negative impact. So we need to look at how we target and frame our messaging so we communicate in the right way with targeted groups so that we don't worsen the situation through communication. Then the management of rhino populations, there's a number of initiatives that we're looking at there, improving the regulatory environment, the guidelines for different land use options. We've seen intensification of rhino populations because of the threat of poaching and how that should be managed to ensure genetic integrity. Also looking at our key populations within the biological management, you have certain populations that are considered key. They are the biggest populations. that we need to look after and secure because they make the biggest contribution in terms of population growth. Also looking at how we can best share best practices. In the provinces there are a lot of best practices that have evolved, engagement with the private owners and ensuring that they manage the population very well, and we want to share that among the different provinces. And then also reporting and monitoring in terms of our biodiversity management plans that we have in place. Linked to that also is the development of the research strategy. So identifying what are the key areas that we need more information and where we can direct research to. And then responsive legislation, it's all about stockpile management, tracking systems for rhino horn. Some of these initiatives will be done by the private sector. And then of course looking at issues around the legislative provisions for domestic trade and making sure that those are in place so that we can effectively regulate a domestic trade. So those are all the issues in terms of the integrated strategic management and we're taking them process forward. Then in terms of the outcome of the Constitutional Court judgment on domestic trade in rhino horn, the committee will recall that we published a prohibition notice, which everyone referred to as a moratorium, in terms of Section 57(2) of NEMBA. This section of the Act says that the minister can prohibit an activity that has a negative impact on the survival of the species in the wild. So the minister implemented the gazetted this notice, prohibition notice of moratorium, in February 2009, and basically it said that all trade in rhino horn was prohibited, and that included selling, giving, donating, buying, disposing of, receiving, etc. So the definition is quite broad, and we use the top, the trend of the species regulation definition, and then it covers all rhino horns and any products or derivatives thereof. So you're not allowed to buy, sell, receive, donate any rhino horn during the period that the moratorium was in place. And it was an interim intervention to allow us to put other measures in place, like the norms and standards, the DNA profiling, etc. So this is just a representation of all the process that unfolded based on the court case. So in 2012 already, Johan Kruger brought a case against the minister, focusing on TOPS, basically asking for the whole trend of protected species regulations to be set aside, as well as the moratorium. He was joined by Mr. John Hume in 2015, and Mr. Hume only requested for the setting aside of the moratorium on domestic trade in rhino horn. So the High Court heard the case in September 2015. During the court case, the part of the case that addressed the top regulations was actually not pursued further, so it focused more on the actual moratorium of the rhino horn moratorium. So the High Court set aside the moratorium in November 2015. The department then lodged an application for leave to appeal to the High Court in December 2015, and it was dismissed by the High Court in January 2016. We then went to then applied for leave to appeal to the Supreme Court of Appeal in March 2016, and that was dismissed in May 2016. We then applied for leave to appeal to the Constitutional Court in June 2016, and the Constitutional Court dismissed the application for leave to appeal in March 2017. So as we discussed previously in the committee, the department pursued the appeals because of the fact that the moratorium was set aside retrospectively. And we found that when the moratorium was put in place, it was a reasonable and rational intervention, and we did substantially comply with the public participation requirements. And we were especially concerned about court cases that have been finalized, and if it is applied retrospectively, it might have implications for both. So the implications of the High Court order that now stands is that it sets aside the moratorium immediately and retrospectively, and that means that it is as if the moratorium was never in place. So it means that the domestic trade in rhino horn in South Africa is therefore permissible, but it's subject to permits that must be issued in terms of our national legislation, which is the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act, or NEMBA, as well as applicable provincial legislation, conservation legislation, of course. the implications on prosecutions that have been concluded successfully, and those which are still pending and still being considered, but that is the National Prosecuting Authority that will be dealing with that. And of course it means that the commercial international trade remains prohibited in terms of the CITES provision. So in terms of CITES, you're not allowed to trade internationally if the import is for commercial purposes. So the way forward in terms of domestic trade in Rhino-Amoy is that we are pursuing the national coordination of permits to buy or sell Rhino-Amoy. I think the committee is very much aware that because conservation and environment are concurrent competence, in terms of our legislation, we've also specified that the provincial conservation authorities, the issuing authority for permits issued to private persons, and the national minister is only responsible for permits issued to entities like Sarasota National Park, Sandy, and other organs of state. So that means that we have to go through a process that's provided for in terms of NEPA to get the permission of the provinces to actually issue permits at the national level. So amendments made to NEPA in 2013 provided for this agreement to be reached in terms of Section 87A3. The written permission must be obtained from MECs for the minister to then be the issuing authority for private persons. So we've initiated that process. We have already received the written agreement from 6 MECs, and we're still waiting for the responses for the remaining 3. So what will happen is that we will then, as the national department, be evaluating all applications relating to the trade in Rhino-Amoy. For those provinces where we do not have agreement, to consider that permit application, we will anyway coordinate. So all applications will come to the department for a recommendation to the province before the permits are issued. So what must be understood is that the department will then only consider permits relating to buying and selling. All other permits, like possession, transport, etc., will still be the responsibility of the provincial issuing authority going forward. So to assist us in this process, we've developed a standard operating procedure and we're developing standard permit conditions. So in the case where we are not the issuing authority, those same permit conditions will be attached to permits then issued by the provincial issuing authority. So the idea around the standard operating procedure is just to do that, to standardize the procedures in terms of permit applications, as well as the evaluation of those applications, and to standardize the issuing of permits and the conditions attached to that. So the committee is aware that we did publish additional regulations related to domestic trade in Rhino-Amoy and for the export of Rhino-Amoy for primarily non-commercial purposes. That was published in February 2017, so that was to further provide for additional requirements relating to the trade in Rhino-Amoy. It included a number of notices, so the one in Section 97, describing the circumstances in which Rhino-Amoy may be sold or bought, and then we also published a notice with a prohibition in terms of 572 that speaks to intentional powdering or shaving of the Rhino-Amoy. So that would, the idea was that that should not be allowed going forward because it's very difficult to control and monitor. It also, one of the notices also proposed a delisting in terms of Section 72, which for invasive species of eastern black rhino, and to include eastern black rhino as a protected species. So that the requirements in terms of permitting, etc., becomes applicable to eastern black rhino. And you must keep in mind that in terms of NEPA, it's a species listed as invasive. You do not need a permit, for example, to kill it. And that would be problematic for us in terms of giving protection to this eastern black rhino. Although it's not an indigenous species, we need to protect it like we're protecting the rest of the species. We are in the process of assessing all the comments received through the public participation process, and we'll be finalising the regulations then and submitted through our intergovernmental processes and to the Minister, and it will then come to Parliament for the NCOP process as well. Thank you, Chair.
think maybe we should take the next one as well, so that we can ask a question, because there's in somewhere where there's a link to the first one. Who's going to be taking us through the second one?
Thanks, Chair. I am the winner of presenting today. It's a pleasure. In terms of this presentation, the brief we received was recent changes in legislation pertaining to rhino warn. So we might have covered this before, some of the aspects of the committee, so we apologize if there's duplication. So we covered rhino horn, lion bones, and hunting issues. So in terms of rhino horn, we just presented on the constitutional court issues. So what we did is to publish the regulations that I referred to in the Gazette in February. And this just gives more detail about what's contained in those regulatory provisions in terms of additional requirements related to purchase and export. If, for example, someone is not a resident, a permanent resident within South Africa. Also, when people can show possession of rhino horns and the marking requirements relating to that, just to reinforce what is already in our norms and standards, the validity of permits for selling and buying, and the fact that we would not accept affidavits as proof of legal acquisition of rhino horn. And that was specifically because the position of rhino horn has been regulated for many years, even before the national legislation, in terms of provincial legislation. And then also restrictions of ports where any horn may be exported from, and those are, of course, only when you've met all the scientific requirements related to such an export, and also restricting the number of horns that may be exported for personal or primarily non-commercial purposes from the country. Then, as I mentioned, a prohibition notice in terms of 52, that specifically addressed fouling and shading, and that is to address the enforcement challenges that you will face if that is allowed. But there are certain exclusions, because when you dehorn, you automatically generate fouling and shading, and there might be the need to actually move those shadings and fouled horn for scientific research, as well as for enforcement purposes as well, for the DNA profiling. And then I already explained the proposals relating to the listing of eastern black rhinos, so no more invasive, so it becomes part of the protected species provisions, and therefore all our provisions relating to protected species then become applicable to the rhinos, which are not indigenous to South Africa. So I already said that we're working on those comments going forward, but we just wanted to mention, although the amendments to the rhino norms and standards are not recent, it's only in the NTOB process now, but it's not a recent development, we did include the presentation to the select committee on those norms and standards in the document pack. And that is just to remind the committee that we've been working on these amendments to the norms and standards from 2015. We finalised that process last year, and it's basically to address certain interpretation issues that we had with the 2012 norms and standards, and also address issues like reporting. When must a person report the national mortality? When must the EMI report to the department relating to the hunt that's been conducted? Also safekeeping issues, etc. So it's not a reason for the department, but it's in the process through the NCOP going forward. And then in our presentation in February, we also just alluded to the comprehensive amendments or substantial amendments to the threatened or protected species regulations. Those are also now in the NCOP process, and we hope to finalize that as soon as possible. And there are, of course, in those documents also specific provisions relating to rhino. For example, you cannot conduct a captive breeding operation of rhino if you cannot demonstrate a conservation benefit. So that's just to remind the committee that those are not that recent, but they're in the process of being finalised. Then in terms of legislation pertaining to lion bones, I thought in terms of background, just to remind the committee that South Africa's lion population is stable and or increasing. We have more than 3,000 wild and what we call managed wild population. The wild populations are populations that you will get, for example, in Kruger National Park, in your big reserves. Managed wild populations are populations that you get in smaller reserves, where we have to do metapopulation management. So the reserves are a bit small, so you have to exchange animals and so forth and actively manage those populations, but they're all wild. So we have a substantial wild population that we are looking at, and then of course we have the captive bed lines, which is about 6,000 captive bed lines in almost 300 facilities in South Africa, mostly Free State and Northwest. And that in South Africa, lion is not really under threat. The biggest threats to lions are, of course, habitat loss, the fact that they are impacted on if their prey density becomes too low, which leads to habitat availability. And then human wildlife conflict is a big issue. They are not very tolerant, especially with humans, like we saw when lions broke out of Kruger a few weeks ago. So, but lion is regulated in terms of our national and provincial biodiversity legislation. In terms of member, it's listed as a vulnerable species. That will be revised. That was revised based on the latest IUCN listing process that we concluded. Lion is now, in terms of that process, considered least concern. The status has improved, and the lion's listing, therefore, in terms of tops, will also be amended to protect it. So what it means is, once it's listed in terms of member, you do need a permit to carry out any restricted activity involving a specimen. As the committee knows, restricted activities include just about any possible activity: possession, transport, killing, hunting, import, export, breeding, etc. And of course, specimens includes any living or dead lion. It also includes the parts and derivatives. So it means that it includes skin or bone. So it basically means that if you want to do anything with bones, you need a permit authorizing that activity involving bone. And then of course, if you have, like with rhino, you have instances of illegal killing of lion. If that takes place, of course, without a permit, we consider that to be poaching, illegal killing. So the Threatened or Protected Species regulations further then regulate activities involving all listed species, and then specifically also lion. And so if you're a wildlife trader, if you have a zoo, if you are a captive breeding facility, rehab facility, etc., you must register. There's a compulsory registration requirement. So all facilities that breed lion are registered with the provincial conservation authorities as such, and they have permits relating to that. When we issue permits, we must also consider a biodiversity management plan. A biodiversity management plan has been developed for lion. It was published in the Government Gazette in 2015, and in that regard, we established a national lion task team to coordinate the implementation of the BMP that's got specific actions that must be undertaken over the next 5 years. Then under CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, the African lion is listed as Appendix 2 in Appendix 2 of CITES, which means that basically commercial international trade is allowed, but you must prove legal acquisition, and there must be a non-detriment finding for the species. So the scientific authority did do a non-detriment finding for the species, and as you've just heard, the species are not under threat. Our populations are quite stable. In terms of trophy hunting, we hunt less than 10 wild lions in a year. But at the last conference of parties to CITES, there was a proposal actually to list a lion in Appendix 1. This is mostly due to other areas in Africa, especially West Africa, where they have some challenges in terms of lion. Keeping in mind that the main threat to lions is, of course, habitat availability and prey-based depletion. I don't know what the thing is used for. So based on the discussions there, a condition, or what we call an annotation, was attached to the Appendix 2 listing of lion, which basically reads that from 2017 there will be a zero annual quota for bones or any pieces of bone products, etc., originating from wild populations, and so no commercial trade is allowed in any bones from a wild population. And then of course for South Africa, with the captive breeding facilities, we need to establish an annual export quota for trading bones and bone pieces, etc., from those facilities, and communicate that to the scientific criteria. So I think we have reported in the past that we had a process through the Scientific Authority and the South African National Biodiversity Institute that considered a number of reports, including the traffic report on that's entitled Bones of Contention, an assessment of South Africa's trade in nine bones and other body parts, which clearly demonstrated a shift from tiger bone to lion bone, where tiger bone trade was stopped, and basically that analysis was taken into consideration, as well as trade data. We have the United Nations World Conservation Monitoring Center that analyzes all our scientific annual reports. The trade data from that process was taken, and South African National Biodiversity Institute did an analysis, and based on that said we export approximately 850 or so skeletons per year from various sources, from hunting trophies, etc. And they made recommendations relating to a proposed quota that was discussed at a workshop where a number of interested parties attended. And so when the Scientific Authority considered the matter, they considered the proposal by Sandy, they considered the input given by interested parties subsequent to the workshop, and they made a recommendation to the Minister. So the Minister is currently considering that recommendation that includes the quota. It includes management and monitoring requirements, as well as research aspects that must be taken forward. So that's lion check. Then the recent changes in legislation pertaining to hunting. Here we were not sure exactly related to the scope, but what we are aware of is that we publish norms and standards for leopard hunting, and so the presentation covers that. What you must understand about leopard is that they are a very secretive animal, so monitoring and so forth are more complicated than with other animals like rhinos and elephants. So there are challenges in terms of population monitoring and so forth, but we have mechanisms to deal with that. So where the norms and standards originated from is that the Scientific Authority did a non-detriment finding. And I just want to quickly explain that a non-detriment finding process doesn't only consider biological information. When the Scientific Authority must do a non-detriment finding, they consider the biology of the species involved, they consider the status of the species involved, the management interventions, control measures that are in place, whether there's monitoring measures in place, as well as the protection levels and incentives for people living with these species. So the Scientific Authority did a non-detriment finding in 2015. From that process, they made certain recommendations relating to leopard, which included, for example, the development of norms and standards to improve the process of quota allocation when it comes to leopard hunts. They also made recommendations for the quota for 2015 in terms of we must prescribe that provinces that do get a quota are not allowed to hunt. No one will be allowed to hunt females, and that there should be hunt return forms that should be considered, but not be submitted subsequent to hunt. So that was done in 2015, and so when the Scientific Authority was requested to make recommendations relating to the allocation of the 2016 quota, they considered the non-detriment finding. They considered the implementation of the quota conditions introduced for 2015 and then additional information that was made available subsequent to the publication of the report. And based on that, they recommended a zero trophy hunting quota for 2016 as well as 2017 going forward. In 2016, they also proposed that we must deal with urgent measures to facilitate sustainable use of leopard populations, which included the development of norms and standards for the management and managing of leopard hunts. They also recommended that we should develop a national monitoring program that has been implemented since then as well. So looking at population trends in the various areas where levels occur. And we must remember that approximately 20% of South Africa is suitable leopard habitat and is not contained by fences, so they are truly resilient, if I can call it like that. So the department published draft norms and standards for the management and monitoring of the hunting of leopard in South Africa for trophy hunting purposes in terms of Section 9 of NEMBA. Also in February 2017 for public participation, and the purpose was to ensure that hunting is done in an ecologically sustainable manner. The provisions in the norms and standards apply to local and foreign hunters, and it applies to both private or state owned or managed land. So some of the key requirements in the norms and standards is reflected in the presentation. It's of course not an exhaustive list, but the key one that we wanted to highlight is that the norms and standards restrict hunting of leopards to males of 7 years and older. And this is because the scientific information that indicates that once a male reaches that age, it has had an opportunity to reproduce. Some of its leopards would have grown up to be adults, so it's made its contribution in terms of ensuring population stability. Of course, as to perennial, the removal of males doesn't have a big bigger impact as the removal of females. And the populations are more resilient if you can retain your reproductive adult females to ensure that they reproduce. Males, of course, can mate with numerous females, and they have large territories or ranges that they walk in, and therefore the impact of the removal of males are not that extensive. Furthermore, there must be a person that wants to hunt must take and pass an online leopard hunting examination. That is specifically so that they, we are sure that the professional hunter or the local hunter can actually identify a male of 7 years and older. And the way they identify them, because of a dewlap, the males develop this, like almost a double chin, a piece of skin that develops under the chin and linked to the neck. And that also, as the leopard mature, that becomes more prominent, and you can actually identify a leopard of a certain age based on the development of the dewlap. So the online examination will make sure that the person can positively identify a leopard of the correct age to be hunted, and it also includes legislative requirements. So when the person does the examination, we have proof that they're aware of what are the legal requirements and that they can actually positively identify a male of 7 years and older. Then the norms and standards also provide for the establishment of leopard hunting zones, and this is to ensure there's even distribution of hunting effort across the leopard range in each province. So up to date, provinces have different systems of allocating quotas. Some would allocate to the farmer or the landowner, others will allocate to the professional hunter, which then hunts on various farms where they have agreements with the owners. So that has an impact in terms of if you take too many animals from one specific area, you have an impact on the population there. And so it creates a sink with animals moving in there the whole time and being hunted. So we want to avoid that and spread the hunting effort across the leopard range. And of course, based on the population information that we have for those areas. So it introduces these leopard hunting zones that will then be established, and that will be established by FANBI in collaboration with the Provincial Conservation Authority based on the hunting information and the leopard population monitoring data, keeping in mind that we've established a national leopard monitoring program. Then within those leopard hunting zones, only one leopard can be hunted in a particular hunting season, and that's also to reduce impact. And then there are consequences if, for example, you hunt a female or an underage male, no further quota will be allocated in that leopard hunting zone for the next season, and there are also implications in terms of the export of those specific settings. Then there's also a requirement to link the permit allocation to a minimum size of the property, and that will be determined by the Provincial Conservation Authority. There's provisions to report on your successful hunt or unsuccessful hunt within 12 hours of the hunt taking place. So environmental management inspector must be informed about the hunt taking place. And then inspection must be done of the hunting territory by the EMI. And I apologize, it's just a small mistake. It's within 24 hours of the hunt, not 48 hours in the document. And then, of course, we're also doing the DNA profiling, so similar to rhino, they must take skin samples and that must be sent for genetic profiling. And then hunting return forms must be submitted to the issuing authority, both for successful and unsuccessful hunts. And this is important because if we allocate a quota in a leopard hunting zone and the hunts are unsuccessful, it means that there is a challenge that they have to address. So that in terms of the norms and standards, if for example there were three non-successful hunts consecutively, we can withdraw the permission for hunting that area and focus first on monitoring again in terms of that. Then also, these hunting return forms include, for example, photos that must be taken. Leopards can be identified based on their spots. Individual leopards can be identified through that. And we get a number of, a lot of information from those photos in terms of the measurements, the sizes of the animals, are the trophies getting smaller, are the sizes maintained. Of course, were the male hunted, and that's why you will also see information relating to the skull must also be provided. And there you can see wear and tear on the teeth. You can pick up a lot of issues relating to the state of the animal that was hunted and confirm the age as well. These photos will be evaluated by experts in the field to make sure that we get as much information from that as possible to inform our processes going forward. And then of course, if these hundred return forms have not been received, then we can decide not to allocate hunts based on Sandy or the scientific authority's advice because it might have negative impact on the population. There's also disincentives provided for in the norms and standards like no further permit that will be issued, restrictions in terms of Africa's ability to market hunts relating to leopards abroad, no export permits to be issued, etc. And seizure, of course, that you can anyway do in terms of EMI's mandate. And that is it, Chair, honourable members, about the project going forward. Same as the rhino regulations, we are in the process of assessing the comments. Of course, with these type of documents, we always get a lot of comments, a lot of interest that we have to evaluate, so it does take some time. So we will finalise it based on the assessment of the comments and then submit it through our approval process. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, those are the presentations, honorable members. Just to recap, basically about, you can categorize them into three. The first presentation is on the integrated management systems for IMO. The second one is on the outcome of the Constitutional Court judgment regarding the moratorium on rhino bone trading. The third one is the recent changes in the regulations regarding the rhino horn, which we've already received a presentation on. And lion bones. There's this issue about what is called can hunting as well. And there's the hunting of the leopard, for which the presentation says the department is busy with the nonsense panel. Okay? So can we just get questions, if there are any? Honorable Edward? 11:07. Maybe before you come in, let me just say something about next week. Next week, we in our program, we had a briefing on the possible introduction of legislation regarding violent crime. Your punishable offense. Remember, we had a discussion about introduction of some form of stiff sentences that will serve as a deterrent for this kind of crimes. We propose that we should also receive that presentation today, because as you can see, we are dealing with wildlife and all these things are related. So we got a feedback from the department, a request from the management that we should leave the program as it is, because the department is not ready in terms of that presentation about the possible introduction of legislation. Although we thought that these issues are oriented, so we will get a presentation next Tuesday on the possible introduction of legislation, which is something that also emanates from the Rhino-led process about the responsive legislation. So we're not going to deal with that now. We will deal with the issue around legislation on the wildlife crime in Rhino in particular when we meet next week. We have received the proposal on the approach, but I've not really looked at the proposed approach from the department, so we'll engage with that after the meeting. So we're supposed to get all those presentations, but unfortunately, on the legislative aspect, the department is not ready yet. I just thought I must just clarify this thing before we start asking questions. Honorable Edward.
Thank you very much, Chair. My questions are going to go specifically on the leopards and rhino, lion boat, sorry, not the rhino side. I just want to double check, I don't know if I missed it, I might have. Will the monitoring function, will that be locally, meaning either local provincial or a national function? But specifically then, who will this be? Will the body be, not the person, but like who will accept to be, to understand what I'm asking, and then also the time frame for, you know, if you need to apply for your permit and do your test, et cetera, et cetera. Do we have an idea of plus, minus, if nothing goes wrong, from the day that you apply, you decide you want to kill this leopard, until like the okay is given, like just an estimate. Okay, and then you say that if an underage male or female is hunted, no further quota will be given for the next season. So for example, you'll kind of stop it. Does that mean you'll stop it for just the season after, and then someone will be allowed to hunt again, or would it be longer? I just want to make double sure. And then the form, you often hear when you go into the community about farmers saying that they're going to hunt the leopard because they're eating, you know, their sheep for the cattle or whatever. What then will the implications be legally for these farmers if they do not follow the route of, you know, applying for a permit? Because I know a lot of these people, especially in your more rural areas where it's far from anything, you know, there's a leopard that's costing them a lot of money, and then they'll just hunt it or whatever, because they kind of get to know where he's going, etc. And my last question is on lion bone. I just want to know, last year at CITES, I went to a couple of discussions specifically on tiger bone trade. And a lot of the professors or doctors, I can't remember, but they mentioned that the trade, if I can put it that way, is moving lower down into Africa towards southern Africa, or in southern Africa. But that people are doing, you know, taking lion bones, because we've got so many lions, instead of the tiger bones. So have you taken that into consideration? Is there any impact or impact study that's been done? It would just be interesting to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I have a number of questions. Please be patient if the relative people can make careful note of them. On the presentation one, it's mentioned the protection of rhinos inside parts of intensive protection zones. Well, I'm only aware of one zone in the south of Kruger. Are there others? And if yes, where are they? There's no numbering of pages for the presentation one, but I'm sure the presenters will be able to follow. We speak of APUs, APUs, and it refers to increased support for APUs in sand parks. There's no. The question is: will the APU capabilities in private reserves also receive support? So we're just talking sand parks or private reserves, and other reserves managed by province like the Impolozi. There's no mention of support for them, and we know Impolozi has been hammered lately. We talk of a launch, a community empowerment plan and champions, no time frames, so if we could find when and where. And then we have a section on demand management and what the department aims to do there. But there are a number of NGOs doing this at international level, and the question is, has any work been done to work with these people and possible partnerships with those? The presentation talks of securing and growing key rhino populations by finding holders of key populations. So what is classified as a key population? Is this limited to the wild, or does it include privately owned? The presentation also mentions finalize and implement the electronic national integrated permit system that enables uniformity and capturing of data and information management. Again, no time frames. If someone could answer that. You mentioned here that the MEC issues permits for private people. I wasn't quite clear who issues the permits for parks and that. If you just clarify that, I didn't catch that. The coming to Parliament for the NCO process, the assessing these comments, is there any idea of timing on that? I'm going to move on to the second session. First question, has the department established a system to monitor the effect that the lifting of the moratorium has had on the market and on rhino protein numbers? And if this is in place, could we have any feedback on it? Has anything been measured on that one? Second session, the one that I'm struggling with is the only two rhino horns may export it for personal, primarily non-commercial purposes, that's by persons who are not citizens of, or permanent. Is it two per year, two per when? Is it two? I'm struggling to understand that, so I think the committee needs to know that. It's very vague. The captive breeding facilities for lions, you said they're registered with the provincial conservation authorities. So are those available to the public? Can the public find out who is actually breeding in captivity? Yes or no? suppression of these recommendations, proposed quotas. This is talking to Lions now. Also, no timing. No timing. So I don't know if it is, or if you can answer that or not. Next question. The Scientific Authority of South Africa. Who is this? Who is on? Is it a board? Is it a body? Who actually sits on the Scientific Authority of South Africa? And what qualifies one to be a member of it? Thanks, Jim.
Slide 11, or the old condom test, it was used back in such an entry, it doesn't make any difference.
That could be my closer
shift. Oh, sorry. I never thought one that I might, my voice can still be low.
Yeah,
okay.
The volume was a bit down.
Yeah, okay. I'm saying on the first presentation slide, or page 11, in terms of the judgment or the order, which the, I think, second bullet, which the Concord upheld, are there any litigations related to that as a result of that, that appeal having been dismissed from people who might have been prosecuted and either successful or whatever, who may want to claim that perhaps were in the wrong or government was in the wrong. The second will be slide 12 or page 12. Bullet 3, wherein MSPs may not, some may not agree to the minister becoming the issuing authority and so on. And as regards the standards that have been set, will that not then cause inconsistencies of the application of the standards in the event at one point the minister issues that is an issuing authority, at another the minister must then have recommending powers to an MEC or minister, whichever that province may call themselves, and then the MEC or minister is the one who now must then either agree or disagree. I think it has got implications to the to how we're going to apply the standards as in the suggestion. With regard to the second presentation, there is one wherein the ideal situation you're saying should be that the port of exit should be OR Tambo, probably for management and for ensuring that human resources concentrated at that level and so on and so on. But my question will then be, don't we have individuals with private jets and so on who land in the country, who may want to exit without having to go through for our Tambo? And what is the process of that? How do you manage that and so on? Mostly this will be wealthy people who may want not to be subjected to the processes in the OR Tambo. The second issue, the leper dam involved, will then say that preferably the underage male leopard and the female should not be hunted. But you have justified that why the male should be the ones that are in this particular chamber. But the issue I'm raising is, I just feel that to just say that you may not issue the hunting license for the next season, it is his mind. And I'm not just raising it as a comment, I'm saying that it then it's more in the favorable condition for the creation of the farm owner who may prefer to go through a season without hunting or something, if we do that. In fact, let me put it differently. Is there no other penalty that can be thought about other than just to say next season there's no hunting here because you violated or something? The last but one question, Chair. If honestly and genuinely, whether in terms of the online or whatever other facility, the hunter mistakenly hunts a wrong animal, a wrong leopard, and so on. Honestly, what is the mitigation? Do you, is there any provision to say then, yes, with the mitigating factors, it's clear that this was committed mistaken, or everybody, whether wrong, what, no, whether it was a mistake or not, and it can be justifiable, you are charged, you are guilty as charged, and you are condemned to the same. I'm just for interest to say. The last one that I said, Chair. In terms of the briefing notes by the minister, the document that you circulated to us, 3.3, that is on page, not page, but we can assume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we can assume page 5, 3.3, the first paragraph, the fourth line. It is said that what we do need, it literally talks to the transformation issues. To say to be able to deal with issues of crime in this regard, particularly where you have got this transnational syndicate who want to deal with rhinos and so on and so on, to ensure that you curb or combat some of those issues. Part of it, you need to ensure that communities gain access to land, and we have got support programs for new entrants so that they are not encouraged to assist the criminals in this particular wrongdoing or scared of killing rhinos and so on. Do you know whether we are successful in that regard? Because the truth needs to go hand in hand. We may come with all these other integrated strategic management approaches to fight crime in that regard, but if it's not accompanied almost with equal effort to ensure that communities have got access to land and in fact are equally party to the economic spin-offs resulting from game farming and so on and so on, will forever have some challenges, because this indicator will entice or will incentivize them and so on and so on, they will fall prey to that. Is there anything to share with the committee in that regard? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I would like to correct one thing that was mentioned in the introduction. I laid forward the apology last week and gave my reasons for not attending the Mashonaland community. Now that it's out of the
way, it was reached my office.
It was sent to the portfolio secretary, Chairperson. I got a record of that.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will just pose three questions. One is with regards to the draft regulations on the for the domestic trade on the rhino horn or part of thereof. I think, on my opinion, is not consistent with the fundamental principles of the Article 2 of CITES, where it only specified that if the permission is to be allowed, it must be allowed on exceptional circumstances, which here is just given a blanket, and that will stimulate demand for the rhino trade in the country. And there are a number of things, even my colleague mentioned one of them. How are we going to ascertain that the individual who source or buying the rhino horn is for personal use? So there are a number of issues that we haven't laid out as a country that we need to ensure that are in place to raise the regulation. Currently we are facing the issue of just managing poaching in our parks. That's an issue on itself. And when we put additional responsibility, it's going to be a kind of a difficult thing to manage. That's my concern when it comes to the domestic trade on the rhino horn or part of thereof. The other issue on the on the lion and leopard trophy hunting, I don't know what are the economic spin-off are derived from those activities. If they look at heritage, is it more worthwhile to have a live leopard or lion than having just one kill in those leopard protected zones? I don't know, what is our thinking as the department? What is it that is driving this demand of even coming with the standards, minimum standards, and saying that, okay, we will allow one to be hunted per season? Why are we falling to that trap? I think it more makes sense, economic sense for me, to have a live leopard or lion, having tourists, thousands of them, which comes to the country, and view them and leave them still alive, then having one being shot from the park or wherever they may be. And the other issue, when it comes to lions, they've got their threats, the diseases that they also were mentioning. You have your canine distemper as well as immunodeficiency virus, which are affecting the lions, especially in the Kruger National Park. Have you looked at the impact that you will have in the future? You don't know when the outbreak will happen of the disease. And that will have a negative impact on the population of the lions in the country. Because you'll never know when it will happen. I know that the population at this point is stable, but you never know when it will happen. Have you put all those into consideration before even coming with these norms and standards to allow the trophy hunting in the country? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello,
Bobby.
Well, thanks very much, Honorable Chair. The disadvantage of in the last list of the questions covered, but I also think on okay, I've gone through the progress report since February 2017, which highlights the progress and so forth. But we know that we are living in a real world situation where nothing is taking, anything is taking. So it will be important for me to be afraid in terms of what is the latest general state of affairs and how, as we speak today, in relation to the general protection of rhinos in our parks, in the provincial reserves, as well as the regional collaboration and international collaboration. Secondly, we know the progress that we've made around the creation of economic alternatives for communities, etc. But we are aware that the wildlife industry is still quite dominated in the markets. And then the question of climate change. The key question that arises is what is the impact of your intervention in addressing the historical pattern of ownership, especially around the revolution? Yeah. That will relate to job creation, local economic development, and improving the quality of life, addressing the triple challenge. Then I've seen in the progress there are a number of provinces where there were paying donations, etc. It has been disaggregated. But I see one province that I come from, the Northern Cape is not mentioned. And the Northern Cape is also endowed with rhinos and wildlife. What is the state of affairs in relation to this? So that we are able to accelerate and diversify the wildlife. Okay, now in relation to the question that relates to your communication strategy, how responsive is your communication strategy in terms of being adapted to rural areas and also tailor-made to the dynamics of a different community? Or is your communication strategy a one shoe fits all approach? That's what I want you to know. Now, I know there's a question posed around the climate and life. I just want to check how robust and strict are your permits. So that you avoid the question of permits being issued out back door and private. Do you have that kind of monitoring mechanism? I know the provincial members of the executive council are responsible for that. But at the level of intake and export, can you get an appraisal of what are the state of affairs? And are there strict conditions to related to that, is there a peer database kept in relation to administration? Help it in respect, Honorable Chair, as I conclude, in relation to private persons. Whether the capacity is kept and whether the capacity to monitor that kind of issue. Last issue. My colleague has raised the question of the implications of the constitutional construction on domestic trade and climate. But there's a mention that you made around Lotus land to be a temporary measure. How temporary? So I'm listening to the connection with the specific. Yeah, so those will be my questions. Thank you.
Okay. I'm just going to also supplement the questions that have been raised or add on that, and then we will have a tea break for about 5 minutes and come back so that you can gather your thoughts and you can share notes and who's going to respond to each question. Now, the first presentation on the integrated management systems of mining. My question is the system working? Are we seeing the results? The statistics which were released by the minister in February this year indicates that there were about 1,054 rhinos which were poached in 2016 compared to 1,175 in the same period in 2015. The 40% of 10%, but 1,054 compared to 1,175 is about 100 less plus minus. So we still have what as of 2016, about 2,000 total number of animals that we have in the council? And what is the death rate if you compare the rhinos that have been killed and that are dying naturally compared to those that have been born? What is the ratio? What is the implication? Are we not seeing a gradual decrease of rhinos year per year? And that, of course, impact on the rhino population, because of all the rhino states, South Africa has got the greatest concentration or the biggest numbers of rhinos. And if we get to this mortality rate as a result of poaching, what is the impact that it is having? On the rhino population, which talks to the success rate of this integrated management approach, whether is it working or is it not working? Okay, and then on the Constitutional Court, I think what did not come out very clear, which might have led to a confusion. I hear my colleague, Honorable Mabido, also was raising that question when you're saying temporal. I would have expected a presentation that talks to the reason why that prohibition notice was put in place in the first instance. There might have been reasons why the moratorium was put in place. And it did not come out of the presentation. I think there was an assumption that we all know why there was a moratorium. And I would have loved to see a situation where you explain the reasons for the memorandum, for the moratorium, that we should call prohibition notice, to be put in place. Of course, there were a number of things that you needed to deal with. What are those things? Because I thought we'd make a case for it. Say, this is the reason why we put a moratorium. The moratorium was challenged in 2015, and the challenge was successful. So from 2015 up to almost this year, what was being done to attend to the issues that led to the moratorium in the first place? Why did we take 2 years to deal with those issues instead of dealing with them speedily? Because this may talk to the attitude towards the court judgment. You know, there was a judgment in 2015 that was successful, which you call the gentleman who introduced that. The Yuan Kuka judgment. So that judgment, one would have thought that as soon as that judgment was awarded by court, the department would have introduced measures whilst on the same time appealing, but introduced measures then to deal with some of the issues there that regarding the memorandum. Now, from what we heard, it doesn't show that there was something that was, the department was doing something about it, because it took 2 years before when finally the department could not succeed, because the Supreme Court was petitioned, it was declined as petition, the department lost that. The Constitutional Court was petitioned. The Constitutional Court refused to hear that petition, meaning that the department failed in that regard. So, which talks to the initial judgment in 2015. So, what was done about it? Why did we take so long to respond to the issues that led to the memorandum being put in the first instance? And of course, the key question is what Honorable Makubela raised. Whether are there any litigation flowing out of that what is the impact in terms of some of the court cases that the department and the NPA were busy with as a result of people having flouted the memorandum of the prohibition notice. Related to that, can we be furnished with the legal costs relating to this litigation flowing from 2015 up to the application to the High Court? On the third one, there's a debate around the question of cat hunting or lions that are bred in captivity, particularly what you call the Panthera leo. I'm sure you are aware of all the debate that I've been exposed to one. And I must say that I, from the information that I've been exposed to, I think the approach of sustainable use that the department is pursuing, I see no problem with that. I think it's the correct approach that this must also benefit the economy of the country. But the issue is whether how the department has responded to some of the key concerns that are raised by those who are doing captive breeding. Are you just dismissing it as it is, or is there something being done to address some of the concerns? Of course, having due regard of the approach that the department is taking or the country is taking about the sustainable use of these natural resources. The bones, this trade about what value is it derived, if I may just ask a question, from this. You said the scientific authority has recommended to the minister that the quota should be about 800. You didn't mention the quota, but I believe it's about 800. What process was followed to arrive at that quota, if I may ask, of those pieces of bones? And on the leopard, what is the current status of status listing of leopard? The presentation makes a point that it is difficult to estimate. I don't know whether is that the point or what, but there's something in that regard. Do you know exactly what is the population of leopards? The population in leopard in the country, and the growth of that population, whether it's growing or it's declining, and what are the reasons for the introduction of this mouse and panda with regard to hunting, and what is the current situation, whether the hunting takes place or there's no hunting of lions. So those will be my questions. I know that there's too many questions that have been asked, so maybe we might afford you about 5 minutes break to allocate the questions to yourself and to show me back what come back. So yeah. No further questions? Can we break for about 5 minutes and come? Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a hotel?
We have a
Thank you.
Three tenets that you find there: conservation, sustainable use and fair and equitable sharing of the benefits arising from the resources. We subscribe to that. Hence, the many things that we find ourselves, because we recognize that our context is different. There are countries that run what we call an open system. The great migration from Tanzania going up to Kenya, it's not obstructed and it's not in the context, in the same context that we find ourselves. Here in South Africa, we don't have purely open systems. Kruger Park may be as big as it can be with animals moving from one place to another, but it's still a closed system that will require human intervention to ensure that there's a balance in terms of the carrying capacity, the animals that are there, and the resources that are there. So are private nature reserves and commercial nature reserves. So when we approach this space, it's got its own dynamics. Hence, the norms and standards on how things can be run and be dealt with in a uniform manner, the regulations that we're talking about, and the many things that we've been referring to here. So we are operating from that philosophy and that point, which makes us different from others. There are others who are like us, and hence all these debates. CITES becomes a very critical space. CITES, in its own tenet, does recognize because it regulates trade. It presupposes that once you talk about trade, this use, this movement, there's something happening in that space. So I'm raising that so that when we talk to some of the things, we can also put them in proper context. There were questions that were raised around transformation. We've taken transformation very seriously. We come from a painful past, especially manifesting itself in the conservation areas. You go to protected areas, you talk about people who have been moved from one point to another forcefully, and you talk to the use of species. We know that history where people will, I don't want to put it in that manner, but you find yourself in a situation where the use and the detachment with an association with species and interaction species were denied. So you have that aspect. So we have taken that as a program now. Our definition of biodiversity economy puts three tenets in the space: transformation, the economic growth, which is the economic potential of the resources, natural resources, contribution, and also the issue of sustainability, conservation. Look after the resource to be able to support transformation goals and also to support economic growth or to contribute economically. So that program in itself has what we call the wildlife economy. It's meant specifically to facilitate for the involvement of previously disadvantaged in the management of natural resources through conservation from the land that they've received back through land restitution or land reform processes. So it's dedicated as such with the support that has to be mobilized to be able to make that happen. So the measurement of the effects or the impact of that would be on the basis of the targets that we have set for ourselves up until 2030 to say how much of that land is now black owned, how much of the resources and the species and the animals are in that space that can be counted, which would not have been if that process had not been in place. The value chain and related activities associated with that economically, how are they facilitated and how are they supported? The capacity required to be able to manage that, how is it being dealt with? If it calls for game donation, what should be the framework and what should be the principles that must be followed, hence the national framework that is being finalized. So there are all those aspects to try and facilitate for transformation, to the effect that ourselves and the Department of Rural Development, together with the Commission for Land Restitution and Land Rights, and if I'm putting it correctly, we have targets to make sure that the land restitution is concluded, but then following that, as per our law, NEMPA, Protected Areas Act, there's what we call co-management. Co-management will say you are the rightful owners of the land remains conservation, but the
land has to be managed by a management authority on your behalf, together with yourselves as co-managers, with an agreed upon upfront beneficiation scheme that would be informed by what the land can provide. So those are some of the aspects that will also facilitate, I think, what Honorable Mabulu referred to, local economic development and transformation interventions that are required. We did, in the implementation of this, there are certain areas that have been identified, including certain provinces that are also part of the system where most of this would have to unfold in the initial phases as we move forward. Not the cases, but one of them, as we also referred to that one as well. So those are the issues. There was a question as well that I think locates itself in the philosophy that I spoke about that talks to tourism and hunting. For South Africa, it's not either or. There are areas that are zoned. There's no hunting in national parks, for example. All these 19 to 21 national parks in South Africa would have to be, they use this in the main, so many other activities that are centered around tourism in particular. But the private nature reserves, and some of the provincial nature reserves and others, you may find that such activities are permitted. So it's not either or, depends on the specific zones, where such is covered, and both of them are part for us, are part of advancing conservation. Tourism advances conservation, vice versa. Hunting advances conservation, vice versa. So we our approach in terms of economic spin-offs, it's not whether this one gives that one. You would find that when the GDP calculations are done, there's input from hunting, there's input from tourism, there's input from the value chain associated with both of them in the manner in which sustainable utilization is applied and the philosophy that we follow in our country. Chair, there was an issue around the stats. There are quarterly stats that are released by the minister, framed around the impact of the integrated rhino management system. You have referred to the latest one in February. There could be another one any time as we move. So the stats, as they are released by the minister, we have noted, as you have referred to, the 10%, and we took it as a big issue, considering the trend over the preceding years to that effect, and we would always want to improve to that effect, and then some of the questions that will go into the details, I think, will also deal with the aspect. I'll hand over to my colleagues, and then I'll come later on. they will interchange as we move along.
What
can I
say on the stats?
Chair, the stats are released by the minister on the frequency that she does.
And what is the frequency?
It goes in on a quarterly basis, yes, which would provide for this period from February, which then in the next one will cover that. But the ones for the years before that would be covered in the ones that preceded the one that you were referring to here. So those stats will indicate even the number of arrests, the number in terms of relative comparison to the previous year on year at that particular time, and that's where the 10% I think that you referred to came from as well. So that's how the stats are taken. We cooperate with the police that would also provide their data and their information. Justice, also the arrests and sentences, would also come on board. NPA, the customs also is part of the system. So in the preparation of the set, the very same teams that we work with together in dealing with the rhino sketch will provide that information, and it's covered in those quarterly updates.
Yeah, but the question was
the
frequency of isn't it you are comparing the two periods,
2015 and 2016. Yeah. So meaning, you can almost say, last tape was like this, this tape was like this. So it's the same period. So the report states that it is a 10% from 1,050 something, from 1,100 and a small number, and to 1,754, which is a 10%, the reduction of about 100. The point that we are making, or I was making, is that there is still 1,000 rhinos killed, because you can annualize this thing if they are, you can compare to the same thing annually. And the question I wanted to find out, relative to the new sort of the offspring, the death rate, when you compare it with the ones which are poached and the ones that is natural mortality. Because isn't it we want to check whether the graph is going up or it's going down?
Yes. I think we'll try and go to that. There is information to that effect.
Okay.
We'll see if in the responses that is covered. But that information that gives that indication seems to be available.
Okay.
Okay. Dave?
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. You'll bear with me. There are quite a lot of questions. So I'll try and address those that I'm responsible for. In terms of Honourable Edward's question around monitoring function, if you're referring to the monitoring in terms of the population numbers, the hunting reports, all of those functions as for leopard, and where it also comes to in terms of monitoring of the volumes of lion bone and so forth, that monitoring function is the responsibility of Sandy. So Sandy, in terms of the Act, is responsible for monitoring all trade. And specifically for the leopard, because we established a national leopard monitoring program, they are also responsible for that. So of course, inputs from the Provincial Conservation Authority, Scientific Services as well. And the department forms part of it, but mainly driven under the responsibility of SANB. In terms of time frames for permits, when, with quota allocations, it works a little bit different. A period for is prescribed in TOPS in terms of permit application, which is 21 working days. In terms of quota allocations, we have a slightly different system because we have to consider all of this information. So the norms and standards say that a person in a leopard hunting zone can apply by 1 September, and then by 30 September, all the information relating to population monitoring, hunt return forms, etc., must reach Sandy. So then Sandy will go through a process to evaluate all the information and see where hunts can be allocated. What we worked with is to have quotas allocated by the end of November, because hunting shows usually take place internationally from over December and January. You are not allowed to market a leopard hunt if you haven't been allocated a quota. So we try to work so that we ensure that the industry or have surety in terms of whether they will have a hunt to market or will not have a hunt to market. So that is how we are working in terms of time frames there. In terms of stopping a hunt for the one season, and I think there were more than one committee member that requested information on this. So the norms and standards says we will not allocate a hunt in that area. Because remember, the hunting zone is not just one farm. It will be a zone of an area where leopard occur, because the farms might be smaller than the range where the leopards are occurring. So yes, the norms and standards say that your hunt will be stopped for one season, but we mustn't forget that the enforcement activities will continue. So if, for example, you hunted a female or you hunted a young male, etc., remember those will be conditions to the permit, because all norms and standards are covered by conditions to permit. So it will be an offence in terms of the Act. And therefore, all the investigations and enforcement measures will follow, which Francis can explain better than me. So it's not just the implication of you not being able to hunt, it's also the enforcement activities relating to that that will follow. And the same for illegal killing. We do a lot of awareness raising. Most game farmers know that they need a permit to kill a leopard, whether it is for causing damage, etc. So there is a process. If a leopard is causing damage, you can apply for a permit to remove that leopard. And that goes with a process. The committee might recall that we've published norms and standards for the management of damage causing animals as well. That requires that the inspection be conducted. So you must be able to show and demonstrate what are the preventative measures that you had as a farmer, what is the losses that you are suffering, and then based on that inspection that's been done, you will get a permit to remove the damage causing animal. The SOPS provisions do allow for you to shoot a leopard when there is imminent threat to human life. So if an animal is going to attack a person, you're allowed to make an intervention. That must be reported within 24 hours. So the SOPS regulations do allow for those situations where you need to take immediate action to save a person's life, etc. And then also provisions for damage causing animals, that's further supplemented by the draft norms and standards that we refer to. So just to cover that, and of course if you do it illegally, there will be the enforcement processes that will take its course. In terms of lion bones and the issues around tiger bone, we will make the traffic report available to the committee members. That actually gives a nice analysis of what the interlinkages are between the two. One of the key considerations that we have to keep in mind in the discussions at CITES is that it is shown that as tiger bone trade is closed down, there is a shift because you also need to address demand. And so what the concern is at the moment, lion bones are sourced from captive breeding facilities, mainly as a byproduct of the hunting industry. And so if you close that down, where will the demand shift? So that's why when we look at the CITES decisions, there were more decisions than this one on lion. There were also decisions relating to studies that must be done about the bone trade, etc., to inform our processes going forward. But South Africa said, let's put a quota in place based on more or less what we put into the market already. And that's why we did the trade report that analyzed through WCMP. So we make available what we have, what we used to make available over the last few years. We monitor that situation in collaboration with the studies that was agreed to at CITES, so that we can see how we need to adapt and what needs to be put in place as part of the adaptive management process. So there is that study, there's also the trade analysis, and then the research that the scientific authority identified, which includes the impact of the bone trade on the wild population and monitoring what is happening, that will be done going forward.
So, Honourable Chair, the issue referring to traffic and WTMC.
So traffic is trade record analysis of fauna and flora in commerce. It's an NGO that has been working with the CITES secretariat for many years, analysing information relating to international trade in various species. So they commissioned the study. But they are now broadening to other areas in Africa, so it will really give us more information if they do the other studies in terms of what is happening in the rest of Africa. And then WCMC, when I presented, I quickly explained, it's a World Conservation Monitoring Center. Each party must submit on an annual basis a report to the CITES Secretariat, which is then sent to WCMC for analysis. So they analyze all the information relating to the permits that we've issued. Before CITES as a SADC initiative, what we asked them to do is do an analysis over the last 10 years of what we've traded in as a region. And so they did each country analysis relating to that, which we can also make available. So that is some of the key information that was considered in terms of the lion bone issue, in terms of establishing the quota. Then some of the other, can I speak to the ones that I must do? Okay, otherwise you're going to
keep. What is the, all right, if we need to expand more on the quota, so you use the traffic report and this other report to determine the quota.
So what happened is we looked at that over the last 10 years, what have we exported in terms of bones and skeletons and carcasses, etc. We also used the information from Lays, who has officials at OR Tambo that actually endorsed the permit, and looked at the information in terms of what are the amounts of the last year or two that they endorsed. And then we also considered that a traffic report. So they gave us an estimate of the number of bones that we put into the market over the last few years. And remembering that we didn't want to close it down because then the demand might shift to our wild populations, which cannot sustain the types of levels of need for bones. And you don't want to dump a whole bunch of bones in the market, like almost an oversupply into the market. So you want to maintain what has been going out into the market, maintain that, and monitor what is happening in terms of any changes. But keeping in mind, it goes with monitoring and research, and it links to the broader study that we agreed to at SANTI that will focus on the rest of Africa, as well as an overall study on what is driving the bone trade, what interventions are needed, etc., etc. So those were the things that we considered. That, of course, goes with management interventions as well, in terms of how permits must be issued, the quotas to be recorded on permits, etc., as well as DNA sampling.
Okay. You didn't answer my question, which was quite of interest. What are they used for?
So it's usually used in traditional Chinese medicines for rheumatism and any joint-related illnesses. The bones, yeah. So that is... they make a wine as well. But in
wine.
So the report that we will make available to the committee members actually go into more details about it, but it is a replacement for tiger bone that's used for the same purposes. Then there was a question around key populations. What do we mean with key populations? Now that is a scientific term, so under the IUCN they have certain criteria of what you refer to as a key population, and it's got a key 1, a key 2, and a key 3 population. And that is because not all populations are absolutely important in terms of sustainable conservation of lions. Some populations are more important. You need to have at least a founder stock that can reproduce. So if you have 1 or 2, it's important, but the bigger populations are important in terms of driving population growth and conservation. So T1 populations are those that are of continental importance, and it's critical to all ecological function in terms of rhino conservation. And that is usually a population that's increasing or stable and has more than 100 individuals, or more than 50% of a specific subspecies. And then T2 is a population that's increasing and stable with between 51 and 100 individuals. And T3 is a population that might be decreasing, but it has more than 50 or more than 100 specimens in the population. So what we're going to do in terms of the lab is we're going to prioritize within those key populations which ones are of priority for us, that we need to support in terms of all the interventions. And that will be on state land as well as on private land. Just to clarify that. Then in terms of the National Integrated Servicing System, I think Madhiriji touched on that. The time frame for that is to have the CITES system piloted in the second quarter of this financial year. And the main aim is to ensure uniformity and ensure that we can gather the information for reporting purposes, and then it will of course also inform compliance and enforcement, because that information will also be loaded onto the system. In the interim, what we have for rhino is we have a national database for all rhino horn stockpiles, and we have a national system in terms of tracking applications and permit issues for rhino, because of the priorities associated with that. Then just to quickly clarify, I think I did in the presentation indicate that MECs are responsible for permits for private people, and the national department or the national minister is responsible for permits for example, Sand Parks officials, Sandy officials, other organs of state. In terms of the assessment of the comments on all these documents, the Leopard Norton Standard as well as the draft rhino regulations, We will submit the finalized documents through our intergovernmental process in our second quarter, so starting from the 18th of July, the first meeting, it will go what we call to Working Group 1, and then MINSEC, the DG and HODs, and MINSEC with the Minister and MECs. And just to keep in mind that after that, Minister signs off, but then it comes into the NCOP process, which is then timelines that we are not completely in control over. And we present to the select committee on those specific issues. In terms of the two rhino horn specified in the draft regulation, this was per year, but we linked it to the fact that you're allowed to hunt one rhino per year, which is also then two horns, and so the same restriction was applied in terms of export. Keeping in mind that that is only for non-commercial purposes, or primarily non-commercial purposes, SIFI explains very explicitly what that means, and if there's solutions related to that, you can only export if you have an import permit. And there's very strict provisions relating to that. In terms of lion captive breeding facilities...
Before you step off that one, so it's 2% per annum. And there's an issue between commercial and private societies define what commercial is, and then no commercial trade will take place international. But then the way the regulations have been formulated, sometimes people are reading into the regulations that it is allowed for people to take away either the horn or whatever that derives from the horn overseas, if it is not for commercial but it's for personal. Maybe you can just explain why you open this, because if it is overseas, it also becomes international. Why do we open that import? Because it's something that can be utilized by many other people. Or it can be interpreted to mean that you are making an opening on the ban on international trade in this area.
Thanks, Jay. It is something that we receive a lot of comments about, and so we are considering the best way to clarify that specific provision. Why we included it is because we thought it had to be specifically addressed, especially if you want to ensure there's uniformity and everyone addresses in the same manner. There was actually no need to address because we have CITES regulations, so we could have not said anything about export and just apply our CITES provision because it already is covered through that. But we felt that we specifically needed to refer to that, but based on the comments, we do understand that it's created some uncertainty and therefore needs to clarify. So that is something that we will address in the final set of regulations. What we must understand is this is a practice that's been happening over the last few years. The scientific secretariat actually released a statement relating to this to clarify, because they were also approached in terms of is it allowed, is it not allowed. Over the last 10 years, various countries have issued permits for personal purposes for rhino horns, because the convention allows for it. The convention's article specifically states that you need, for appendix one, you need an import permit first, and that country that issues the permit must be convinced that it is not for, or satisfied that it's not for primarily commercial purposes. And so this has happened not from South Africa necessarily, but other countries have issued. You can go to the database and have a look. So it is a process that as CITES management authorities we are familiar with. And I understand that maybe the public is not aware that these processes have taken place, but that the convention itself makes provision for this distinction between Appendix 1, Appendix 2, and primarily commercial purposes and those things that are not primarily commercial purposes. And so we just wanted to make sure that everyone is on the same page and everyone understands what will be the requirement should you want to export. And in that process, maybe the public got a bit confused by saying, oh, but now you're opening it up. But it wasn't the opening up. it was to try and be clear from the start what will be required if you want to export, considering that scientists have certain requirements that must be met. But we will try our best to clarify that in the final regulations for that we will...
But will there be any harm if we completely restrict ourselves to domestic and don't make any reference to export? Because when you export, it's again international. Will it make any harm to focus on regulated domestic trade in Ireland and leave this thing about export? But also taking into account that there are some other countries which have placed a complete ban on the import of rhino oil. And what will be, because they won't be able to issue the import permits because they have got a complete ban on the import of rhino oil. Surely you want to share
the regulations are meant to deal with domestic issues. So the point that the Honourable Chair is raising is that comes to a point where we then say, like Pierre said, the international aspect associated with the interaction with rhino and its derivatives or whatever that be has to be covered through CITES. That's the international protocol that we have at the moment. So whether we have or we don't have domestic trade, the international protocol, as agreed in CITES, applies anyway. So whatever we do at the domestic space, it's immaterial in terms of changing what already exists, which countries agree upon every 3 years. So that's why Pierre is saying, with the comments that we received, this particular issue came in the manner that you're raising, with a lot of people saying that you're now opening up international trade, which is not our competence in terms of the international law, through that the space that CITES can deal with. And CITES has pronounced on that, even in the CITES. So the application of whatever that goes to international, whether it's live rhino or whatever, will then have to continue to be dealt with from a CITES point of view. The question then we see our saying is, how then do we deal with this issue on the regulation, given some of the, whether it's the issue of clarity or whether it's the issue of framing it in a particular manner to avoid this confusion. Because there's no way we can flout the international process, even if we can do whatever we want domestically. We did have a moratorium. The international process was there. Whatever that happens, the international process will still be maintained.
Because it creates a confusion. Maybe the reference must be to CITES for the regulation so that you clarify what CITES is. CITES restricts in terms of commercial international trade, not in terms of personal. So if there is a complete ban, for instance, in terms of CITES, for the Appendix 1, it's only for commercial, not for personal.
Thanks, Chair. Yes, the procedure that you follow is specified in the articles of the Convention. So for Appendix 1, it says that you need an import permit first for Appendix 1, and there must be confirmation that it's not for primarily commercial purposes. So in that, it specifies that you cannot use it for commercial purposes. When you've imported. And it's very strict. It includes you can't donate that specimen, you can't generate money from that specimen. So like a circus is a commercial venture. So you can't export for those purposes. So the articles of the convention puts that what people refer to as a prohibition in place. But we must remember that the country can have stricter domestic measures, and that is, I think, what she is referring to. So another country can have a decision that they will not allow certain specimens into their country, and they're allowed to do that in terms of the convention.
Okay. Because my question was whether for personal use is allowed to do trade as long as there's an import permit.
You need to have the permit. It must be import permit first, but linked to that, of course, is legal acquisition and still the non-detriment finding, and all those provisions are standard for everything. But then for appendix one, import permit first to confirm that it will not be used for commercial purposes.
So even if somebody is from China is coming here to buy whatever for personal use, wants to export it to China, China has got a complete ban on it. So that person won't be allowed to take it to China.
Yeah.
I think this is something that has not been clear, you know, because when we talk about no international trade, many of the people, and I think even the stakeholders, assume that it's for commercial and non-commercial, no international trade in terms of the site. So I think it's a matter that must be clarified when it deals with the regulation. Because it's not for us to decide whether for personal or for commercial use. It's an international trade which is subject to international agreement. So it's not for this committee or this country to decide on it, but it's a matter that the regulations must clarify so that there's certainty around the country around this issue, which is an issue that has caused much of the commentary around the regulations. Okay. Proceed. No follow-up on this regulation.
Thanks, Jay.
Just on this one.
Thank you, Chair. I'm wondering, Chair, if we spread the entire class regulation, will it do any harm in the current situation? I'm just wondering if the entire class regulation are spread, because we do have the international legal framework that exists for the trading of the species in the endangered species. According to the director, Mr. Shoni, he said that it doesn't matter whether we do have our local domestic legislation or whatever it is locally, it won't have effect, but there is an existing international framework. So I was wondering if the entire thing is correct, will it do any harm to the country?
No, but remember, we still have to regulate how domestic trade is done. Remember, the cost that is allowed. The department put a moratorium. It was challenged, and the cost that domestic trade must be allowed. So you must regulate how it happens here, so that it's not a free for all situation. That's my understanding of the regulations, which they seek to make sure that it's done in an orderly way, you know, and all of those things that are supposed to safeguard the interest of the country. So the question whether the regulation should be there or not be there is a non-question. It's a non-question, because the regulations have to be put in place to regulate trade domestic. Because you can't stop it from happening, because the court said it must happen. And that issue was taken on appeal in the Constitutional Court. The court has said the decision of the High Court remains, so the decision is that it must happen. So how it's supposed to happen is an issue with the regulations are dealing with. Now, what the point that I think we're raising is that clarify the international aspect of it in relation to the export in the regulation. he wants to respond, but also it's my responsibility to make sure that you are also understanding correctly what the committee is saying.
Mr. Chair, the interpretation of what I said was on the basis of the question that you asked. When, insofar as it relates to the clarification of personal information, that's where my response was going to. It has nothing to do with the the regulation and no regulation. Our standpoint is what you are alluded to, your idea. Because I was qualifying that only point when you were saying there's clarity that's required to avoid confusion on the international aspect, which is in line with what you just said.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. And just to add, although we can use our current national and provincial legislation to regulate the rhino wound trade, we do think we need additional measures that we want to, that is built into the regulations, especially around procedures, because legally procedures are important as well as conditions, etc., and we want to specify that in the additional regulations. There was a question about captive breeding facilities, lion captive breeding facilities. Our understanding is that if you follow the PIO requesting that information from the provinces through the existing PIO provision, you might be able to access it, but that process should be followed. In terms of the
requesting information around the province, what information?
It's about whether captive breeding facilities, the information about who has facilities, etc., can be obtained. And that information is held by the provinces. Remember, provinces issue permits for private individuals, and so that must be requested through a process. We consolidate.
Here doesn't have information about facilities.
No, we do have information, Chair, but we're not the issuing authority for those facilities, and therefore it should be requested from the issuing authority through the proper processes, like BIA. Because we can't make information.
Honourable Pardon wanted to find out how many of these facilities were they located. It wasn't about permitting, as I understand. It was about where are these facilities, how many are they.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. So I think I indicated there are just below 300 facilities in South Africa, and the main areas where they are found is Gqeberha and Northwest, so Southern Limpopo and Eastern Cape as well. So that breakdown we can give, but not who's the owner and exactly where he's located. That should be requested through FIA.
Yeah.
FIA,
the FIA process. If the fire process wasn't already here, because here there will be questions, there will be expectation to respond to the questions. When you are referring members to fire now, it's like it's an additional bureaucratic process that has to be followed. But if you don't have the information, and the information is with the provinces, but if you have the information, can just give to the committee. These are the facilities, this is where they are located. Anything that you don't have, you don't have. And if members want to get more, they can always ask if they need to get more information.
Chair, if I may, in addition to quota issues around lions, as the compliance and enforcement unit within the department, we actually have a project focused on compliance monitoring that we do together with the provinces through what we call one of our MINTEC working groups, Working Group 4. There's actually a national project to go and monitor compliance at the lion breeding facilities. So we've just kind of started that project now, but we will obviously, I think we've visited most of the breeding facilities in the Free State. And now we're moving into the Northwest Province. So perhaps if the committee is interested in the outcomes of that project, we can bring that back to the committee once we finalize that.
So let's leave the fire out of the information that should be available, and information that must be given. Whatever you have. If you don't have any more, you can't give any more. Okay.
No, Chair. Then there was a question about when the quota for lions will be made available. As I've mentioned, it's with Minister for consideration, and she needs to make an informed decision relating to that, and therefore I contact at point in time when it will be communicated with. In terms of the scientific authority, the scientific authority is provided for, it's established in terms of member, section 60, and they have a specific mandate that they are responsible for, including monitoring of trade, giving advice relating to certain activities, including, for example, quotas. And then the Threatened or Protected Species Regulations further make provision for the composition and the operating procedures. The scientific authority is composed of a representative from SANDI, Sand Parks, the Department of Environmental Affairs, a rep from each of the provincial conservation authorities, a representative from the museums, and then also a representative from the National Zoological Gardens. And of course, the requirement is based on the mandate that they have to fulfill, so you need to have knowledge about scientific issues as well as the procedures and the requirements in terms of scientists and costs. So that's just to clarify the question.
It's just called the scientific authority.
Yes.
Is the structure, is the body, is it just the forum? How is it constituted and how does it operate?
So it's established in terms of the Biodiversity Act. So the Act establishes the scientific authority. Originally, you will hear about the scientific authority in the scientist context, but within NEMBA, they also have a mandate to provide guidance and advice on matters relating to threatened or protected species.
Is it a body? Is it an institution? What type of authority is it? Are there offices that belong to it?
No, SANDI provides for all the logistical arrangements relating to it, but it's, I don't know what to call it, a committee?
A committee?
Yes, it's not a formal structure like SANDI is a structure. It's representatives from the various organs of state that I referred to, and they meet on twice a year, and they are responsible for things like making non-detriment findings, giving input on specific matters relating to restricted activities like quotas, monitoring the trade that is taking place, etc. So if I can... Yes. So what I can do is to take those sections out of the Act and just make it available to the committee.
If I may add, Chair, they are formally appointed by the Minister in line with the provisions that he is talking about in the Act. So it's not like any other committee that will meet there and there, the following day, the other representative coming because it comes from the province. There are specific names and specific people that are duly appointed and an authority that will provide the functions that she will send through. In the main, providing the scientific information that's useful for decision making. That's where all these non-detrimental findings, they will follow a certain scientific process and provide that support with recommendations that we'll have to consider in taking the decision.
And then SANDI provides the secretariat, and of course,
it seems like Pia's in a rush to leave yet, the way she answers so quickly.
No, she speaks like that. She's fun.
We have representatives of SANDI, Sand Parks, and I couldn't catch the others. In each provincial conservation authority, what are the other seats?
My apologies, Chair, I will,
honourable
members. Yeah, so it's the Natural Museum, the each provincial conservation authority. Of course, from DIA, there's two representatives to cover both terrestrial and marine issues with our Oceans and Coast branch, and then also the National Zoological Gardens. So in the revised top, what we've done is we brought in tertiary institutions, and we would bring in DAF, the Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, especially with, for example, sharks being listed under CITES and so forth. So we bring in those in through the top amendments that have not been implemented. There was a concern about consistency. If all provinces do not give permission for the national minister to issue the permits relating to trade, so what we're trying to do is through the standard operating procedure address that. And there was another question relating to whether we go and what monitoring mechanisms do we have in place. So I just wanted to explain that we actually have a section that goes and do compliance monitoring in the issuing authority. So they go through the applications and the permits that's been issued to see if the legislation has been consistently applied and correct, the interpretations are correct and the permits were issued correctly. And then there's a corrective actions report that is sent to the provinces on any issues that they might pick up in terms of non-compliance or procedures not followed correctly. So that compliance monitoring to further ensure standardization is taking place. And then, of course, where we find the need to enforce standardization further than the regulations, we develop the norms and standards, because norms and standards they cannot deviate from. So for those key things, we then develop norms and standards. So there is a compliance monitoring process going on, and then specifically for Rhino Horn, we will have the standard operating procedures. And so when the application comes from a province that does not give permission for the minister to issue the permit, we will, in our recommendation, specify the conditions to be attached and how the permit should be issued to further ensure that there is no
deviation. Those provinces?
I think it's KZN, Eastern Cape, and Free State at this point. So it's not that they are not willing, they're just in the process. It's a process to get the written agreement. The others have already granted permission. Then the relating to Honourable Khadere referred to Article 2 of CITES Convention and that our regulations being, I don't know, I think we've addressed that. Just to keep in mind that CITES only relates to international trade and it doesn't affect our domestic legislation in terms of what we regulate in terms of our national legislation, like activities taking place within the country. It only applies to international trade and permitting required for that international.
Yeah, but there is a resolution of CITES regarding the domestic trade in Ireland, which was taken in CITES, which something that's special from what you're talking about, CITES regulating international. They are not domestic.
Yeah, so they are certain areas.
But there's a special parliament.
Thanks, Chair. But just to mention that that's also linked to illegal international trade. So there must be a clear link between the two and the various other issues. So I'm not sure whether I've addressed all of the issues. I think, Chair, you had a request relating to the activities that took place, the moratorium was put in place, and I thought I touched on it, but I just want to make it very clear. So in 2009, when the moratorium was put into place, recalling that we already started public participation in 2008, at that point in time, we had various challenges. Pseudo hunting just came in, where people coming into hunt a rhino without actually being hunters. We had the increase in rhino poaching. And that is why we said we needed the intervention at that point in time to say no movement should take place until we have proper measures in place to regulate it. And since then, we implemented a number of interventions, and we actually have a document that stipulates those that we can make available to the committee. But most important, for example, we had the poaching, the rhino poaching issues declared a national priority. We had a strategy on the safety and security of rhino that was developed and approved and implemented. We developed the norms and standards for rhino marking and trophy hunting. We, the whole issue around DNA profiling was developed and included in our norms and standards for rhino hunting. We had the whole rhino horn stockpile audit process and the capturing of that information on a national database. We had the capacity at ports of entry and exit was addressed. At that point in time, we didn't even have a directorate that dealt with biodiversity enforcement issues. It was established as part of these processes. And over the years, we've implemented all of these measures. From enforcement side, they can reflect on all the issues that they've done in terms of addressing ports of entry and exit, in terms of training, having dedicated capacity there. We developed the biodiversity management plan for rhinos. So yes, the actual regulations for domestic trade, additional regulations, we only did now. But there was a number of things that we did since the moratorium came into force to actually try and address the issues that we had to deal with and why the moratorium was put in place, that spoke about better control, improved records, and the rhino horn stockpile is one of those. So in 2013, we did do a study, the feasibility study of, what is it called, feasibility study about the viability of uplifting the moratorium. And that indicated that the moratorium is not, of course, supposed to be a long-term intervention, but there were still some things that we had to address. And the rhino audit was, stockpile audit was one of them. So in between the processes, we did do a check to say, should we lift the moratorium? What will be the implications? What are outstanding matters to be addressed? And those recommendations coming from that report, we also addressed going forward. So it's just that we would have been in a situation when we are ready to actually go through a process to consider lifting the moratorium, but the court case, of course, pushed all of that, turned that around. So we were working through multiple interventions to address the issues around
I want us to move to a closing. My concern was that in their report, excuse me, those issues don't arise. You know, you don't make a case for why the moratorium. You are only making it now. By the way, this gaps that you needed to deal with. But those things are not in the report. And I'm saying, for now and even for future, when you report, you must start from there. There was a moratorium, these are the reasons for the moratorium to be put in place. Because there are questions out there, why now the new regulations? And the first people to explain to the committee to say, there was a moratorium, these are the reasons that we put this moratorium. And for now we think that we addressed everything else that was outstanding, and we think that we are ready to lift the moratorium. That's the point that I was making, that it doesn't come across, because if anybody were to ask, but why the moratorium in the first place, now you start explaining which explanation was supposed to be in your report. So, yeah.
On that. Chair, I heard you in terms of wanting to wind down.
Yeah, but before that, there were concerns around canned hunting. Whether you have addressed those concerns. Some of them, you remember, I was with the Shoni in the Honolulu, the conference with the IUCN, when these issues were raised there, about there was a video which they called the Black Lions, which raised the concerns around the but of course they did in a very dramatic way. But there are concerns around that, and I just wanted to find out how are you addressing those concerns.
Thanks, Chair. The department's view relating to canned hunting is that we have existing provisions in place in TOPS that prohibit certain activities. So, for example, you're not allowed to hunt a line that's under the influence of a tranquilizer. You're not allowed to hunt a line in a controlled environment. There are certain prohibitions that we have in place that are also linked to canned hunting. The problem is that the term canned hunting is not defined. So people have different understandings of what it entails. And so some people's understanding is that the hunting of a lion that's been bred in captivity is canned lion hunting. So not all the other prohibitions that we already have in place in the TOPS regulations. And there the challenge relates to the to ethical considerations, concerns about the whether it's ethically correct to hunt a lion that's been bred in captivity. But we regulate those activities. We, as a department in the provinces, we regulate that if you want to keep them and breed them, these are this is the requirements in terms of breeding and keeping. If you want to hunt them, these are the requirements and you need to be authorized to hunt them. And therefore, we don't dismiss concerns. We are looking into that, and that's why Francis was referring to the project that they have. And it's because concerns were raised about how these lions are being kept. Are they being kept in compliance with these permit requirements, etc.? And that's why we initiated the project, to actually go to these facilities and confirm that they do have the necessary permits and do meet the requirements. And we will continue with that. So that enforcement compliance related activity will address some of the concerns that people raise.
I wanted to add one line. There's no law in South Africa that talks to cat hunting, which then, as Mia indicated, people attribute anything. For them, the definition is not about the confined space, that something is in a cage and then you take it out. Then they refer to anything that has to do with the whatever that has been bred in captivity, which is another matter. But what I'm saying is that the legal provisions that we have no reference whatsoever in terms of promoting cane hunting as opposed to what people are saying.
Okay. So the regulation that DAF was supposed to promulgate, how far is
this? I don't have the actual information in terms of that.
Because they were used to animal welfare. Remember, it was part of the issues.
Yes. Yeah. We're still pursuing that. We have an interest in that. They are aware of that. And I would not be able to give you an informed response to that at the moment.
Because, anyway, I think the matter that has been followed up, because most of the concerns were around the welfare of this animal. Despite the conditions that were put, but there were some instances where some hunters were sort of not complying, killing the animals in a manner that was a bit inhumane, not a bit, they considered it to be inhumane. So the welfare issues that were supposed to have been finalized by the Department of Agriculture, Forestry, were supposed to continue in place. So there's still an outstanding issue that we aspire to do in this matter. It's not quite interesting.
Yes,
before that, do you have an idea of the number of leopards in the country?
Thanks, Chair. We were discussing whether we must give this as one of those where you have a range, like we also give for rhinos. When we say when we do census, we say there's between 6,500 and 7,400 or whatever in there. But in terms of the published information, it's a range between 2,800 and 11,400, which shows you that's more or less the figures. Let me get the exact figures before I quote it incorrectly. According to Swanepoel et al., there's approximately 4,476 leopards. The range is between 2,813 and 11,632. So you can see the range is extremely broad, and that is because of the difficulties of counting leopards. At the moment, we're using camera traps to that's placed in areas in leopard habitats, and that is part of the monitoring program. So they are placed where we think we will the area is suitable for habitat for leopard, and then that is recorded. But also keeping in mind that we mustn't count the same leopard as five different leopards. So that is the information that we have at the moment. It's listed on Appendix 1 and the CITES, and we have a CITES approved quota of 150 animals that we can export per annum. So that's what we referred to when we do quota allocations before. But it must please be kept in mind that we've never used 150. We've always allocated approximately 75, and if you look at the hunting stats, then you will see that less than that 75 is hunted, because sometimes we allocate a quota, the hunt's not successful, etc. So we've exported, in terms of the hunting stats, it's usually between 35 to 45 or so that we actually exported. But of course, for 2016, we had a zero quota, so no hunts were allowed, and for 2017, the same, no hunts were allowed. In 2015, we only allowed the hunting of males, and there was also a requirement for a hunt return form that had to be completed.
And this is in the way?
Yes. We don't have, as far as I know, we don't have captive breeding of leopards and subsequent hunting.
Okay. Why do you allow, I mean, the argument around violence is that don't hunt the lions in the wild because they are going to be extinct. Why do you allow for the leopards? Seeing that there are very few, I mean, leopards, 4,000 estimated in a range. Why should you allow that, Shoni? I mean, if the argument, because the argument was consistent, if the argument around captive breeding of lions is that you save the ones in the wild, why not do the same with the leopards? If people want to hunt for trophies, they can go and kill the ones which are kept bred in captivity, instead of the ones that are in the wild. Why are we doing that?
The prohibition is one, but other methods. That's why earlier on I was talking about the sustainable use, hunting industry as part of this, and its support of conservation. They are referred to certain specific conditions. She didn't go into the details of the type of a male that could be removed and all these other things. In the main, you would want to target males that are already post their, I don't know what to call it, their productivity, they are not necessarily in any way contributing to the survival of species moving into the future because they've gone past their production state. So there are those aspects into the details when it comes to how we deal with leopards. Of course, informed by the quota. The quota determination will say, if you have this type of an offtake, you don't affect the growth in terms of the numbers and species and the survival of the species in the wild. So that is the information that we normally use to determine what we didn't see it as a contradiction.
Well, it is a contradiction. Definitely it's a contradiction, sorry, to remember that the animals in the wild must be as protected as possible. If you allow hunting, it must, according to how you approach the lion hunting or the lion trade, it has to be the ones which are in captivity. But anyway, let's talk of that one. We don't have enough time.
Just a quick one. The hunting of lions in the wild is also regulated.
Yes.
Not that there is a moratorium.
Yes. I'm aware of that.
Okay.
It's allowed, but you encourage that it must be done from these ones which are in captivity.
Okay.
the trading of the bones, the hunting and so forth. But anyway, we don't have enough time. I think let's just get this one, including the identification. You spoke about the online, yeah, whether the potential hunters, they are aware of what somebody was telling me outside, that she saw the hunter, but she just found that thing in few minutes. Yes, that's what she told me outside. So it's not the system that is more robust that can identify the hunter from somebody, just an ordinary person. But it's something for another day. Can you just get, I'm sure we'll be interested to get a follow-up discussion on this.
I just wanted to deal with a couple of the compliance and enforcement related questions. I think the first one was asking about the intensive protection zone in the Kruger Park. We've learned a lot of lessons from what has happened in the Kruger Park. And as a result of that, through the Rhino Lab process, you'll see we only put a summary on that one slide. So a lot of the other initiatives that are not there is about how do we roll out that intensive protection zone into other parks. And we've set up a subcommittee of MinTech under Working Group 4, which actually brings together Sand Parks as well as all the provincial parks. And all of those Rhino Lab initiatives are being rolled out through that process. So we're looking at other intensive protection zones within certain reserves. We're looking at building up and what is necessary in order to build up specific anti-poaching, specialized anti-poaching units within other reserves. So a lot of that work is happening through the subcommittee. There's a lot of training that is happening. We've got advanced grade 5 ranger training that is being rolled out at the moment. So there's quite a lot of work through implementing the Rhino Lab initiatives that is taking place that I'm sure we can come back and talk to the committee about. Then just in terms of the judgment, I think there was a question that asked, has any litigation flowed as a result of that. I quickly in the break spoke with the head of the prosecution section at our national DPP's office just to check, and she says she hasn't heard of any litigation following it, and she would have been the first person that would have heard of it. So I think we're still going to maybe see some of that coming. I think what is important and one of the primary reasons for us taking...
I think was that litigation, but also what happens to the cases which are prosecuted.
Yes.
Under the
moratorium.
Under the moratorium,
So what happened with a lot of the convictions and the cases that were already tried and gone through the process, the charges wouldn't have only been a charge around the moratorium. So there would have been multiple charges that dealt with other aspects as well. So if somebody traded domestically and handed over a horn to somebody else, there would have been other charges. So, for example, they wouldn't have had a permit for possession. Remember, even aside from the moratorium, there were permits and a whole lot of other legal issues that were required. So the charges are not just about the moratorium. The charges also go into other charges for various offences. So what I think we might see is we still might see some of those people who've been charged and imprisoned coming forward to say, surely our sentence should be reduced based on the fact that that was one of the charges and that has now been set aside. But we haven't had that yet. Maybe they're preparing for it. What we have done with cases that are currently, that haven't been tried yet, that are in the court process, so for example, the very well-known ones, Grunewald, Rust, those kind of cases, where in the Grunewald case, I think there's over 1,800 charges, is we've gone back and looked at those charge sheets and determined which are the charges on that charge sheet that might have been impacted by the moratorium, and there's not a lot. So there's quite a number of other charges that relate to other offences. So the prosecutor is busy looking at how she needs to review that charge sheet before they go back to court. And remember, I mean, the retrospectivity issue was the big thing. The reason that the department went all the way up to the Constitutional Court is that we wanted to, you know, if the moratorium was set aside, we wanted it to be set aside from the date of judgment rather than backdating all the way to 2009. So it is important that as we review those charge sheets, we look at when, you know, the various illegal activities took place, so that even those that go back today, we'll have to remove those. So there is work that is being done by the prosecuting authority.
Which is an issue because the biggest issue was retrospective application of the judgment. And the expectation was that you will identify that these are the actual implications. These are the number of people who have been charged as a result of that moratorium. And what it will then mean for the department. Remember, you spend a whole lot of money just chasing this retrospective application. And you said it has got implication. But where we are sitting, we don't understand. No, you are not taking us into confidence about what are the implications of that. How many people are we talking about who are affected? What are the cases? At what level of prosecution we are on?
Actually, the prosecuting authority is still busy with that exercise. So, you know, the constitutional court judgment came out not that long ago, and the latest that we heard from them is they're still busy looking at those cases. So it's difficult for me to give you a definitive answer because, you know, they are the correct body to look into that aspect, but I'll go back to them again.
Yeah, but you see, the problem is you can't talk about it when you can't quantify the implications. Remember when you approach the Constitutional Court to say we have got a problem with the retrospective application of the judgment because it has got huge implications. What did you tell the Constitutional Court what are the implications? Because surely if you can quantify it, these are the cases that you are dealing with. And this is the implication if the Constitutional Court does not reverse the retrospective application of the judgment. And I don't know what is to say to the Constitutional Court about the implication.
What we can do is to make our affidavits available. So we did explain to the court that, and we got information from the NPA to include in the affidavits and the supporting affidavits in terms of these are the implications, these are the ongoing cases. Because there are some cases affected, for example, the last matter is not affected because they were not charged in terms of member provisions. But others did have implications, and we tried to, in our affidavits, explain what are the implications associated with that. So I think it is publicly available. We can make those affidavits available to the committee.
Okay. So you didn't think it was necessary to be included in this meeting? Because that's what we wanted to find out. Remember, this is a water under the bridge. The Constitutional Court has denied application. Or appeal. So the judgment remains. And what we needed to find out was what are the implications of the judgment? What is this thing that we have been pursuing? When I heard of it, I called Sean to say, but why are you guys going right through to the Constitutional Court? When you can address some of the issues that are arising from the judgment. Because it's costly to go there. So Shoni told me that what we are not happy with is the retrospective application of that judgment because it has got huge implications for some of the cases that the department is dealing with. So I wanted to find out from him, but he referred me to the legal person. So when we asked the question during the presentation of the APP, he told me that, no, Chair, we're coming to brief you on the implications of that. But now this is the briefing that he was referring to, and those implications are not specified in the briefing. So my question was, what are these implications that made us go all the way and spend all the money? What are they? We're still quantifying, the NPA is still quantifying something that we said to the court that there are huge implications, but we don't know what are these implications, we're still quantifying. I think think we deserve to get some much more than this. These are the indications of the judgment. And that's the reason why we're persisting in our arguments. But tell us implications, let's look at the implications. Oh, you're fine. And so, Honorable Hokwe, but you can proceed and finalize. You see, we are not being unreasonable. We are not being unreasonable. We want to find out. We don't want to say that these implications are not serious or not serious. But we need to find out what are the implications that you are talking about. Up to so far, there has not been any litigation arrival from the Constitutional Court by any body. So it is that one we know. Maybe it might happen in the future. But what are these implications? Because that could have been the implications today. Hey, there is a floodgate now of litigation against the department as a result of this retrospective application. So there is none as far as we're concerned. As far as, remember, you represent the department here. So what you say to us is what the department is currently dealing with. So there's nothing.
I thought I did not need to raise it this way. But the flip side of if it were to talk of the two sides of the same coin, the other side may be that the department, through the legal position of the department, failed to convince the court that there are implications. To the extent that the court realized there's no need to look at the retrospective nature of the thing, you could not come forward in mitigating factors to say, on the basis of the flow, we think it's, if it looked like that, government is going to, or the government is going to be in the front line. So if you are not able to convince the judges or whatever, your justice, then they can't grant you that. I'm saying I do not want to raise it, which is what I'm saying. It gets to that point. Because if you commit an offense, deliberately or whatever, the judges ultimately say, what do you think are the mitigating factors? Then either you start saying your personal issues, either you've got your family, you know, all those kind of things. Now, so when you appeal for all this, you needed to have that case on right. To say there are cost implications, there are the following and so on and so on and so on. People are in jail already on the basis of this thing, and who are these people, what their numbers, whatever, and what does it mean to those people who are either jailed erroneously and so on the basis of that monitor. So I'm just saying, when you look at the whole thing, what is not being said, maybe, but perhaps we did not, or government did not, put a case that was so convincing.
It's a very difficult, Chair, for me to respond in my acting capacity. But we can provide that affidavit.
About that, because you see, that's why I keep on saying, we don't want to sound unfair, but you know, when the court takes decision, we respect those decisions. If we differ with them, we take it to, we review, take it to the next level, which is normally the High Court gets reviewed in the Supreme Court of Appeal. We take it there. If still we lose at that level, it's only under exceptional circumstances where we feel very, very strong that we have to take it to, we have to take it to the Constitutional Court. And in this case, it was fine. So it means that you felt very strong about the retrospective application because there are implications. So what are the implications? Are still being referred. I don't think that is a very good answer to that question, because before you go to the next court, Earth, what are its implications? Remember, the courts are there to assist us in public administration to do the things properly. If they are adjudicated on the basis of our papers, it would mean that, look, they've looked at this thing and there's no issue, therefore we don't have to waste public money. Because there's no wastage in this instance. If we can go to that level.
Chief.
The wastage because... are you interjecting?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Just wait for me to finish and let it come. So, you must have felt very strong to take this matter up to the Constitutional Court. So what we're simply asking, what are the implications, and they are not there. You are still assessing, the NPA is still assessing what are the implications. Now our view is that that's not a good enough one. We asked this thing during the presentation of the APP. We were told that in receiving a briefing, and this is a briefing, nothing that is coming out of that. You see, there's somebody who's occupying the position on the suspension level who's not here, and you are acting in difficult for to respond. Our view is that let's have a follow-up discussion around this issue of the education. So that we can the reason why I asked about the cost was a very deliberate question to want to understand what it costs you as a department in persisting with the argument that this thing is wrong and it must be looked at. And you have found one thing in as far as it was said by the court. And it came at a great cost. I don't know what were the cost. Maybe you can tell us about the cost.
Jay, the response that I got from our litigation officials was that at this stage it is in excess of 1.5 million rand, and that was our cost. In relation to the applicant's costs, because judgment was made where the department must also pay applicant's costs, there's a consultant that needs to be brought in to do a full assessment, so that hasn't been determined yet. But the response that I got was that it is in excess of 1.5 million.
Excluding the other parties.
Excluding the other parties.
Which may be the similar amount or maybe more.
Maybe, yes.
Mm.
But I have heard the chair and I will give feedback to my DDG that
okay.
We will have a further discussion on implications and perhaps we can bring the prosecuting authority in there because I know that they did assess the implications at the time, I just wasn't involved. And perhaps they can also tell you about the process that they're busy with now, which is looking at very specific cases.
Okay. The implications and the costs of the department, if you can also get that in the same report.
Okay.
Because it must not be easy, you know, to... Quite often what happens is that we get judgment from the court, which are well-argued, well-reasoned, and for which we must just comply. And quite often we don't do that. We just persist in our wrong argument, in our wrong belief. We take it, you know, even if there is no ground for the appeal, we continue to do that, knowing that the resources that we are using are not our own personal resources. You see. And the point that we are making is that we must be very circumspect when we are utilizing the resources of the people of this country. It's fine, we can appeal if we think that we are right, but it must be based on sufficient ground to make that appeal. It must not be that, hey, you know, we have been embarrassed on this instance and therefore we must appeal. You know, that is the point that we are raising. As we do that, and it's not only this method, there may be other methods which may not be a good idea. easier to take them on review. And sometimes, it gets taken on review and keep on losing and losing. It's not very good. But of course, we'll have a follow-up discussion, and I'm sure some of the issues will be taken into account.
And we'll ensure that correct people are here to provide that feedback.
Well, if they are not around, they work overseas. We may be stuck with yourself again.
That's fine.
Talking to the report that is there. But it's going to be good that the relevant officials are around so that we deal with these matters and we dispose of them. The intention is to make sure that we don't find ourselves in a similar situation. Sometimes people get a wrong impression that we just want to grade people and to make them look bad. No, that is not the intention. The intention is to help to do it proper next time.
I understand, Chair, the difficulty in these cases was also that both the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court didn't actually give reasons for decisions. So I think in those cases, they didn't come forward and say, this is the Supreme Court of Appeal.
Let's not have a dialogue.
Okay.
Remember what happened. The Constitutional Court did not even listen to it.
Yes. Or the Supreme Court.
Or the Supreme Court. They just on the paper, just looking at the paper, they just dismissed. Normally, if you have got merit, there's a case made, they sit down and they listen and you come and make arguments and they decide. When they decide, they will give reasons. But when you don't have a case straight away, they just write it back, the register tells you that, hey, this thing has been dismissed. Go back to work, comply. Anyway, I think all the issues have been attended to. Do you want to? Were there some other outstanding?
There were just one or two outstanding issues, and there were a couple of community issues. I think the only one from my side was probably about the mistaken hunting by a community member. Obviously, any hunting of leopard will be investigated, and depending on whether the person has the intention or negligence, the prosecutor will then make a decision not to prosecute. So it's just important that all the circumstances will be taken into account, and investigations will take place. And then the last one was just with regard to the court. I think there was a question around, there's other people that might want to take Horn out of other smaller courts. The plan with the domestic trade issue, and it is going to leave the country in terms of this long discussion around where the two can be. It would have to go out of OR Tambo if the regulations go through in the way they are. And again, it's just to make sure that we can control that. Currently, in terms of CITES permits, it needs to go out of CITES designated ports. But if we allow it in terms of Rhino Horn through these domestic trade regulations, the idea is to bring it down even further to one port. And the idea would also be that it can't be on your passenger luggage. It has to be through a proper consignment process. But these are the comments that are coming up through the comments on the regulations. So these are things that we're still assessing whether to do it like that or not. And then I think Rose just wanted to deal with one or two of the community issues.
Okay. Also, Chair, if you allow me, she also deals with the international aspects associated with the cooperation that we have had with other countries.
Yeah, if you can do it quickly.
I'll be very quick. Thank you. Thanks, Chair, and apologies again for being late. In fact, part of the reason I'm late is what we were doing had a lot to do with ensuring the inclusion of communities that Honorable Makubela raised. It was an exercise with the Eastern Cape Parks Tourism Agency in Port Elizabeth in their Great Fish Nature Reserve, where they have also seen the threat escalating on the killing of their black rhino. And the exercise was to try and seek support donor funds from potential donors to assist in the onset of community-based projects that can, as you correctly indicated, can assist to relieve Commission is indeed taking seriously, and that a big part of the biodiversity economy and the integrated management system has to do with active involvement of communities and the improvement of their livelihoods. So that was just in response to that concern that was raised by Honorable Makoba. Chair, let me start with or just follow with responding to the issue that was raised by Honorable Padden about the time frame for the launch of the Community Ambassador Plan. It is an initiative that, as you saw, is within the RhymeLab, and the time that was set during the RhymeLab was March 2018. But in our planning, we saw that we will have a resource challenge, and I think we postponed it to the subsequent year, the 2019-20 financial year. However, the activities that will precede that that have been identified in detail within the RhymeLab process, and I think yes, it is proper that we should come back and chair to update the committee on the outcomes or progress on the RhymeLab in due course. Talk to specific pre-launch or pre-planning processes like the identification of specific hotspot areas where this plan will be rolled out to, and that has already been initiated and it's underway. But there are set time frames. The RhymeLab is very specific in terms of what should be done when, by whom, and how. So that is all well defined within the RhymeLab. And the slide, of course, will not be in that detail. And then the issue that was raised about the progress, Honorable Mabilo, I think I will just couple that with a few others because the integrated approach covers almost all the areas. But I think a lot more detail will come in the statement that the Minister will, in due course, release. However, just to pick on, at a very high level, to pick on some notable concerns that you have raised. There is good progress in terms of international cooperation, especially with our frontline states. Mozambique work is going on. I think the last time we came here, we reported that Minister was going off to Mozambique to go and find, to meet with the both ministers from Mozambique and Minister from Zim. That has happened. And preceding that, a day or two before, was the signing of an agreement between the Mozambique government and the private concessionaires. That will also be yet another program that will assist in private public partnership with the affected communities that they will be benefiting out of the operation of private concessions. In addition to that is the resettlement program, which is underway in Mozambique on schedule, and we will have our quarterly joint management committee, which we use to drive the implementation of the MOA with Mozambique on the 1st and 2nd of June in the Kruger National Park with our Mozambique colleagues. So that is, it's actually running very well. We've established contact points. The compliance and enforcement colleagues also have a working team which has got SOPs in place and specific protocols on how to conduct BNA, who to contact, and all the standards that must come with it. So that is in order. Chair, our collaboration with Vietnam as one of the affected countries is also very much in order. That youth program that has been undertaken was recently assessed, and the impact thereof I think is something that we must also come back and share, because it was run by the NGO that we supported through the Rhino Protection Program. And the outcome of that is quite positive, but I think at a later stage we will have to come back.
When we come back to discuss the issues, maybe we should have that feedback, not only Vietnam, but all the consumer countries.
Mm-hmm.
What is the relationship with them?
Okay.
Yeah. We don't want to be unfair to you. We know that you can brief us on these issues that you are dealing with. Unfortunately, you are coming at the tail end and we don't have time, and we don't want to do injustice to your responses. So maybe let's engage on those issues when we do a follow-up.
No, noted, Chair. We will also include the obviously how that is impacting on demand management, which was also raised today. So when we do that brief, that will also be part of the brief. I think lastly, specifically the involvement of the frontline state is one other that we have also put more focus into, and that will also come in the brief. Following with an eminent MOU to be signed with Zimbabwe, which we are very far in the process of development.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Should we want to highlight
just to say thank you, Chair. We have noted a number of areas that we need to follow up on, and we will do so. And just to say that the rhino space, the sustainable use space, has got its own dynamics, and we are equally concerned as everybody else in making sure that our policies, our operations, our interventions achieve what we want to see happening. Of course, there are specific measures that would test whether we are going there or reaching the objectives that we want to achieve. There's so much that has been invested in this space. I think we top so many countries, if not all, in terms of the investments in this space, and those investments should indeed result in the intended outcomes. We thank you, Honorable Chair.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for coming. Thanks for the presentation. I know that in the biodiversity, or generally the department, of course, a lot of dedicated men and women who are competent doing their jobs. We want to strengthen what you are doing. We want to make sure that we give you support, encouragement, continue to do the good job that you are doing, but we also raise issues where we think that we need to improve on it. And one of the things that we want you to assess is this integrated management system, whether it is having the desired impact. It's a very good approach. I know it comes from the right level. It's a good approach, but let's assess what impact it is having going forward. I asked a question about the interventions. Are we seeing the graph going down, or are we seeing it going up in terms of the coaching, which I guess you may not have all the figures to respond to that. Don't worry, we'll discuss and engage in the next session. But I think we must continuously do the evaluation of whether it's working or not working. One of the things, however, that we know is that the poaching levels are still very high, unacceptably very high. And we need something drastic to intervene to make sure that the rhino do not become extinct. Something very drastic needs to be done. I don't know what it is, but from where we are seated, we think that it requires some serious challenge in terms of dealing with the poachers, hunting down the criminals and punishing them. We think that, among other things, you need that. But it's a matter that we seem not to be on the same wavelength in terms of the approach of the department, but we engage because we think that we need to strengthen legislation and talk to punish those
criminals who are killing the psychotic species. So we'll continue to engage with that. On the constitutional court issue, I think we've agreed that we need a follow-up discussion to get the cost, to get all the implications, and so forth. And I think on the question of the leopards, we have given you food for thought. You can think about it. if you think that the approach that is taken is correct, that will be the decision that you have to take. But we think that there is a need for you to rethink this approach in terms of the finalization of the minimum losses standards on the question of leopards. Because the primary mandate of the department is to look after the minimum, make sure that we conserve the animals, the species grow, and we attract tourists to come and look at these animals. We don't open them up to a situation whereby they will be hunted legally and illegally and they will somehow perish from the face of the earth. That is the conclusion, honorable members. I thought it was going to be a 2-hour meeting. Taking us some time, but thank you very much for your contribution. We must thank you, Shoni, together with your team. You must continue to do the good work there in the department. You must not be discouraged when you criticize you on this or that. All right, the meeting is adjourned.
Doctor, I just need, I've got the framework, I'm fine. I just need that.
Excuse me. So you recorded the whole thing. Were you wanting to get some cards from it, or did you not record it?
No, I just recorded it. It's only on our
website. Oh, will it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Recording
for
our presentation.
Oh,
great. On the BNG website.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So how, what's the time frame? What do you say?
A week.
Okay. Okay. Perfect.
And would you just send me your contact details?
I will send you my
lovely.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Have a good day. Goodbye.